attendee. We have four attendees, five. Okay, they're just starting to come in. I got it.
Right. They won't show up until we broadcast. So we are now live.
Okay, I'm going to wait a minute or two. Just it sounds like there may be a lag for people coming into the room. So we'll give it a good old computer lag time. And Jonathan, how about you let us know when you think things have settled down and we can get started?
Yeah, that's fine. Let's give it one more minute, see if there are any stragglers. We're pretty steady at 37 attendance.
Okay, great.
You're probably safe to go ahead and start, Arthur.
Okay, great. Welcome, everybody. I'd like to call to order the Hood River City Planning Commission meeting for Monday, August 17th, 2020. We are meeting by Zoom per the governor's emergency order and city council rules and orders, emergency orders that allow us to do this. We know it's not optimal for everybody, but we will do our best. We are conducting one public hearing tonight, and we certainly want to hear from all of you, and we will do our best to do that. But before we jump into the public hearing, I'm going to start, as always, we allow the planning director to update us on anything he needs to update us on. So Dustin, do you have anything to tell us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have meetings set up, and coming up, we have public hearings booked through the next month as well for a number of items. But tonight, we know we have a large audience joining in. We expect a lot of people talking, so we're just going to get right into the public hearing tonight. So we'll be here for questions if you need them. And thank you for everyone who signed in using your name.
Yeah, we certainly appreciate that. We like to know who's out there. I think I'm supposed to say that this meeting is being recorded, but I think we always record our meetings, so I'm not sure that that's surprising. So let me begin. There is an official script I need to read, and I apologize. I'm sure that most of you have heard the script many, many times, but I need to go through it for legal reasons. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to call to order the August 17th, 2020 hearing of the Hood River Planning Commission. My name is Arthur Babbitts, and I will be presiding tonight as chair of the Planning Commission. Let me begin with a description of tonight's process and a few disclosures required by state law. First, our function in these land use cases is to review the record for each application, take public testimony in a hearing such as this, and then to determine whether the application meets or does not meet the applicable approval criteria in the Hood River Development Code. It is not our job to be more restrictive or more lenient than these approval standards allow, but rather to interpret and apply the approval standards as written. If you have any questions about what are the applicable approval criteria, they are listed and analyzed in the staff report that was issued for each application prior to tonight's hearing. They will also be explained as part of the staff presentation for each hearing. So when Jennifer talks, watch that carefully. Second, we are required to render an impartial decision on each application. This means we cannot have personal financial stake or bias that would prevent us from making an impartial decision. Before we begin each item, I will call for a disclosure of bias, ex parte contact, and conflict of interest from each commissioner. Anyone in the audience will have a chance, right, will then have an opportunity to question any of us about these disclosures. Our decision tonight will be final unless appealed to the City Council. To appeal our decision, you have to participate either orally or in writing before the record closes on the item you are interested in. You must raise before us any issue you wish to preserve for subsequent appeal to the City Council or LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals. You must also present to us any evidence you might wish the City Council or LUBA to see. Once we close the record on the item, that will end your ability to raise new issues or present new evidence. Let me describe the order of events for tonight's first hearing, first and only hearing. First, we will hear a staff report, which is a verbal rendition of the written report that was issued prior to tonight's hearing. Second, the applicant may present testimony. You can assume that we have read the application and other materials in the record. And there are certainly many pages of that. So please focus on any changes to the proposal or new information. We also want to hear from the applicant any objections to the analysis and any proposed conditions in the staff report. Finally, we ask that if there is opponent testimony later on, and we know that there will be, the applicant should keep careful notes and in your rebuttal, respond to the opponent testimony. Frequently, public testimony on land use applications pertains to how the development will function or what impacts it will have. The applicant is often in the best position to answer those questions. Third, anyone in favor of the proposal may testify. Then we will take neutral testimony or questions, neither for nor against. After that, we will accept testimony from anyone opposed to the proposal. Finally, the applicant has the final right of rebuttal. The applicant has the last word because the applicant has the burden of proving compliance with mandatory approval criteria. After that, we will check to see if staff has any parting comments following the conclusion of all public testimony. Finally, after everyone interested in these matters has had a chance to testify, we will close the record, deliberate, and we may render a decision tonight. Our decision, however, is not final until it is reduced to writing and officially issued. Nine, our decisions are final unless appealed to the City Council. To appeal one of our decisions, you need to participate orally or in writing before the close of the record, and you must raise any issue you want to preserve for such an appeal. If you need additional time to prepare testimony, you can ask for a continuance, or you can ask that the record be kept open. If you want either of these options, you must make that record, you must make that request during the public testimony portion of the hearing before we close the record on this item. Here are some rules for presenting testimony. Only present testimony in the order I just recited. It says do so at the podium. So you can stand in front of our virtual council table via Zoom. Number two, begin with your name and mailing address. Number three, please limit your testimony to applicable approval criteria identified in the staff report. Our decisions are governed quite strictly by these approval criteria, so you should tailor your testimony to those criteria. Again, those are the criteria that Jennifer will be explaining. They're the only issues we can take into consideration. If you believe that other or different criteria apply, please identify those and explain to us why you think they apply. Number four, failure to raise an issue accompanied by statements or evidence with sufficient specificity to allow us or the parties to respond to the issue will preclude an appeal to the City Council or LUBA based on that issue. Number five, failure by the applicant to raise constitutional or other issues related to the proposed conditions of approval with sufficient specificity to allow us to respond to the issue will preclude an action for damages in circuit court. And finally, we may set some time limits on the presentation of testimony tonight, although there is no limitation on written argument that may be submitted. That is by way of procedural introduction for tonight's hearing. If there is anyone with questions about this process as we go forward, feel free to ask them during the public testimony portion of the hearing. Also, what I like to do is I like to stop right now and give people an opportunity to ask a question. And let me point out that we do have our city attorney, Dan Cairns, present, so he will be able to give us more authoritative answers to our questions than we might sometimes get. So let me explain that if you want to ask a question, I believe the process is you click on the participants button at the bottom of your screen, and that will give you an option to raise your hand. And Jonathan is monitoring that, and he will let us know, and we will turn your mic on. So does anyone have any questions about procedure this evening?
Arthur, I did not see any hands raised at the time.
Great, and so we'll give you another chance. When we're taking testimony, you can raise your hand to testify and you can ask procedural questions at that time too. So let us continue. So Dan, would you like to make your statement now before I go into the specifics, before we go into disclosures, or would you like to wait until after we do our disclosures?
Why don't you do disclosures first? Because what I have to say is a little more relevant to the merits of tonight's hearing.
Right, got it. So we will do that. So we will now consider the item on tonight's agenda, file number 2020-03, an application by Urban Development and Partners for a site plan review for multifamily co-housing development, including 25 dwellings and 3 buildings, a parking lot, carport, 2 common buildings, pathway and walkways, street frontage improvements, and associated site improvements. A quorum of the Planning Commission is present. In fact, I think we have all 7 of us present. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So all 7 planning commissioners are present tonight. And I will now ask all the commissioners to disclose any ex parte contacts, any conflict of interest, or any bias in this matter. So I'm going to do it in the order that I see you on the screen, which may not be what you're all seeing, but I'm going to start with Megan. Megan, can you disclose any ex parte contact, bias, or conflict of interest on this matter?
Yes, and just for clarification from Dan, definition of ex parte and bias.
Yeah, Dan, why don't you go ahead and explain that as long as we're here.
Sure. An ex parte contact is any information you have obtained about the matter outside the context of the hearing. So that would include if you visited the site and personally observed it, or if you were buttonholed at the grocery store by someone who talked to you about the merits, or you went on a weekend trip with the applicant. So those would be ex parte contacts, and you're required to disclose the substance of those at the first opportunity, which is right now. A bias is prejudgment. So a bias is someone who's so irrevocably committed to a particular bent that they can't be objective and base their decisions solely on the record and the approval criteria. They have prejudged the matter. And finally, a conflict of interest is that you have a direct financial stake in the outcome of the matter before you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So zero conflict of interest. I'll start second with perceived bias is that as a walking and biking advocate, I have been involved on the background of trying to create a neighborway that would connect from Katie's Lane, Andy's Way, down to Eugene. And somebody could argue that this Adams Creek co-housing would help create that neighborway. And then in terms of ex parte, I will make sure to list all of these. I am neighbors and friends of Peter Zurcher and Becky, who are part of the Adams Creek co-housing. I attended a Adams Creek co-housing potluck 2 years ago before I was a planning commissioner. And then when I became a planning commissioner, knowing the potential conflict of interest, I decided to not attend any more potlucks. But I do hear updates from my neighbors regularly. Then I am also friends with one of the opponents, Kelly Morris, and we had talked about her opposition to the co-housing. And I believe that is it.
So Megan, what's helpful is the point of the ex parte disclosures is so that the applicant and the opponents have a chance to rebut what you have learned. And so it gets into the record and we all are operating from the same information. So can you tell us any conclusions that you drew from any of those contacts that people need to know so that they can respond in their testimony?
Okay, so let's start with Becky and Peter. And my general awareness of the co-housing is that from the very beginning, it was, I was drawn to the concept because of the creation of community. I watched the documentary Happy, and co-housing is one of the biggest determinants of happiness. And they are always very forward in that that was one of their motivating factors is the creation of community and then the idea of mitigating transportation related carbon emissions. And so I would say those are the two biggest themes that that was general conversation. And then in terms of my contact with Kelly Morris, she made it known that the scale of the development was not something that she was in favor of, and that she perceived the design as changing over time.
Okay, thank you very much. Sue, you're next.
I have no conflict of bias, but I did do a site visit just today to get a feel for the layout of the land, and really just drove by it, so I couldn't see it in much detail, but I did get an appreciation for the amount of vegetation there, and I think that's some of the concerns that people have is what trees will be cut down exactly. And a feel for the nature of Eugene Street, which honestly I'd never even driven on that before at that end because it is a dead end. So it's exceptionally quiet. So those are the two things I learned today.
Thank you very much. Mark, you're next.
So I have no conflict of interest or bias or on the ex parte. I also did a site visit today. I drove down Eugene for the first time in my life and I peeked over the barrier at the end of the road, primarily to try and understand the height difference between the road and the land. Part of the narrative talks about the fact that that first building, unit one or building one, is set down. I don't think it's set down that great. I'd be interested in hearing what the height difference is between Eugene Street and the land. Which building one would sit on. But to me, it wasn't a great, it wasn't like it was 10 feet difference. It was quite level.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark. Bill, you're next, Bill Irving.
We can start with ex parte contact. I have visited the site. The property was listed for sale and I showed it to some prospective buyers a number of years ago. I have not visited the site since then. I am familiar through just advertising and I think website of what's going on a little bit with Adams Creek co-housing. I am third item on, I'm on the board of Big River Community Land Trust, and the land trust has been in some preliminary conversations about getting a unit or two or working with Adams co-housing on a unit or two to that would meet our goals. But I think as I'm exempt from any, there's no personal financial gain and I'm on the board of a nonprofit. So.
Okay. Dan, do you want to?
I don't believe I have any bias or any conflict. So.
Dan, would you like to comment at all on his understanding concerning being on the board of a nonprofit?
No, I think he correctly stated that he's not subject to those rules because it's a nonprofit. That's his only connection.
Thank you very much. Erica, you're next.
Great. I have no conflict of interest, ex parte, or bias.
Well, that was simple. Thank you very much. Tina, you are next. Tina, are you having trouble unmuting? Tina, we're not hearing you, Tina. I think we had this problem with Tina last time that she thinks she's unmuted, but it's not unmuting. Tina? Okay, so I will do my disclosures and then we will come back to Tina, make sure that she is participating in the meeting. So let's see, in terms of conflict of interest, I have no conflict of interest. In terms of bias, I have no bias. In terms of ex parte contact, there are two things which I will note. Number one is that a party to this sent a letter stating concerns about the planning commission, I'm sorry, the planning staff deeming the application complete, and they copied me on that letter. That letter has now been included in the public record. So it was included in the materials that we received last week. So I believe that it's no longer ex parte if you all have a copy of the same letter. I did not have any discussion with this person other than receiving that letter. And then in my role as a local historian, I am quite familiar with the history of this particular site. And what I will disclose on that is that based on my understanding of the very early European settlement and then the earlier native settlements in that area, I will be asking whether the conditions adequately address the following of state and federal antiquities laws. So that's kind of, I think that qualifies as an ex parte information that I have outside of the general record. So with that, let's try to get Tina again. Is she totally gone now?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we lost Tina from the panelist. We're going to try to retrieve her or provide a little tech support here on the side.
Okay, so we can continue along, but we're going to have to remember to get Tina's disclosures before we proceed. When she signs in, we're going to have to get her disclosures. So let's continue. So that was our disclosures. And so now we have the questioning of the disclosures. Would any commission member like to make a motion to disqualify? There's Tina. Tina, is your audio on now? Oh, let me unmute her. Tina, you're muted. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
We hear you now. So we are doing disclosures. Yay. We need to hear from you about conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contacts.
Okay, no conflict, no bias. Ex parte, I also did a site visit on my way home from the pool on my bicycle. I wanted to go through because I was interested. I've been on the site before when it was the estate, the previous owner's estate for an estate sale. And then I went through today because I was interested in the road network, how I wasn't sure what kind of state Hazel was in, and I didn't know if there was a street where Adams Creek Place is proposed, so I rode my bike through there. What I learned is that Hazel is indeed almost like a gravel alleyway. It's very different from the rest of Hazel, and what is proposed as Adams Creek is very narrow, which I was kind of interested in how much space there was for that road. So I didn't measure it, but it was significantly narrower than Eugene. So those are my observations.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So now I'm asking whether any commissioners have any challenges. Sorry, let me just get the right language here. Would any commissioner, I'm sorry, so we each just made our disclosures. Now, would anyone in the audience like to question any commissioners on any disclosure, ex parte contact, bias, or conflict of interest, or otherwise challenge the participation of any members of the commission? So we'll do this again, where we're going to ask you to raise your hand in the participants room. We see 61 people in participants, so please raise your hand there, and Jonathan will let me know if you'd like to speak, and it is your chance to question us on our disclosures or challenge us on our disclosures. I see at least one hand went up.
Yeah, the one hand went up and then went down on its own accord.
Oh, okay. So we're going to assume because your hand went down that you did not wish to speak. You're probably just testing it to see if the function actually works, and it does. So does anyone wish to challenge any of us? I'll take that as a no. Next is, would any commission member like to make a motion to disqualify any other commissioner from hearing this application? Does anyone have any challenge of any of the other commissioners? I'll take that as a no. So now we're about to do staff report, but before we do that, I'm going to ask Dan Cairns to speak, our city attorney. So go ahead, Dan.
Thank you. I just have a few brief comments to make to kind of give a state law perspective on how it pertains to this matter. It's a little unusual tonight. In that you have a standalone site plan with no discretionary permit associated with it, and it is a site plan for what's defined as needed housing under state law. So as a site plan proceeding, the I guess the planning theory behind site plans is that it's a use that's allowed. And the site plan proceeding and all the criteria that you are going to be evaluating tonight, they go to how this use is going to function and what it's going to look like. And typically, site plan criteria cannot be used lawfully as a basis to deny a particular use. It's how is it going to look? How is it going to function? Also, under state law, site plan is considered a limited land use decision, meaning there's limited to no discretion involved. And as a result, the city's comprehensive plan is not a source of approval criteria for a limited land use decision. And finally, as under state law, and state law has been evolving over the years on this subject, but under state law, this is considered to be needed housing as state law defines it. And there's been a good deal of litigation over local approvals and denials and conditions of needed housing in recent years. And the upshot of those cases is that local governments are prohibited from using discretionary criteria to decide an application for needed housing. And also you're prohibited from applying any conditions that are not clear and objective, which means to have any element of discretion. Also, they can't involve kind of discretionary design elements. Those are the basic guidelines for how state law applies to this proposal. And if I have any questions, I'd be happy to attempt to respond to those, but that's the view from the state level on this proposal.
Great. Dan, let me start with an obvious question. If no discretion can be used in a site plan review such as this, why is the Planning Commission involved? Why isn't this done by staff ministerially?
It could be. Under state law, it could be done. It could be done without a hearing, in fact, as a limited land use decision. But it does. State law doesn't prohibit a hearing, and it doesn't prohibit decision from a Planning Commission. Therefore, you evaluate the site plan approval criteria, decide whether there's sufficient evidence in the record that those criteria are or could be met through conditions of approval.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from commissioners?
Mr. Chair, I got an add-in. Per the code,
go ahead.
This use is permitted subject to administrative approval, but I do have the discretion when I see it to refer such questions and some such requests such as this to the Planning Commission. Given the anticipated number of people who'd want to speak on this matter, as well as the opportunity for them to be heard in public session before the decision makers, as well as the opportunity for the applicant to speak to the merits of their proposal, and at my discretion, I immediately move this to be heard before Planning Commission rather than approved administratively.
Thank you. So before we go on to the next step, any further questions for either our planning director or city attorney? Go ahead, Bill.
I guess one comment. I mean, the engineering and could you comment, Dan, I guess, on the engineering and traffic requirements, for example, to be those, I guess, comment on how those could impact a finding or decision here.
Sure. The city code.
Because some of those are quantitative, but not criteria driven by us, for example.
Correct. Engineering criteria, including those related to transportation, are typically very quantitative. So there's a trip generation trigger for whether a full-on traffic study is required versus just a traffic information report. And also the critical issues on traffic are affected intersections. Do they have capacity to accommodate the traffic anticipated from the use? Typically that evaluation is done if the land is rezoned. So the initial time, the time it's initially rezoned to its designation, that determination has to be done. ODOT gets a comment on those things. And then when an application comes in, the traffic engineers evaluate whether the thresholds are met or not met, whether the traffic contributed will cause any affected intersections to drop to a failing level of service, or whether there are any documented traffic safety hazards. And documented traffic safety hazard is a pretty high threshold. It's depending upon documented crash rates over a certain period of time. And so that's how that safety issue is evaluated.
Did you make a comment on that as it relates to pedestrian connectivity, access, and traffic?
There might be something in the code about that, but typically that's not a traffic engineering issue that's used for approval or denial. The site has to be improved to the, as far as the city's TSP is concerned, for pedestrian facilities, but otherwise, it's a traffic engineering evaluation is trip generation, that's vehicle trips, and intersection level of service, and then the possibility of a documented traffic safety hazard, which is car crashes.
So a traffic impact could generate a requirement for offsite improvements by the applicant, but pedestrian impacts could not. This is what you're saying.
It's extremely rare for offsite improvements to be justified for transportation issues.
Okay.
At that point, the city would run into constitutional problems if it were to require offsite improvements, because those are deemed to be existing deficiencies that can't be attributed to this use. And so you can't make a developer construct improvements and fix deficiencies that it did not cause as a general matter.
Just as a heads up, commissioners, we do have Stoner Bell, city engineer, in attendance. Typically he's not with us, but he is available and on this call or on this video as well for commentary.
Thank you very much. Any further questions for Dan? Dan is going to be leaving relatively shortly, so he will be available if any problems come up by text, but he will not be present to monitor this whole thing. So if you got questions for him now, might be a good time. Okay, so seeing that, I have some really brief comments I want to make based on my experience in running quite a few of these hearings. And really what I just want to do is set the tone. I understand that there's a lot of passion on this issue, and that's completely reasonable because we're talking about people's homes, we're talking about their neighborhoods, and people care about this and can be very energetically opinionated on those subjects. That said, our job tonight as Planning Commission is to be decidedly dispassionate. Understanding that will help you make testimony to be more effective. We're only allowed to decide, as you heard, on whether the proposed site plan meets or does not meet the rules. So everything that you can do in your testimony to tie it into those rules to help us appreciate why you think that the conditions are met or why you think the conditions aren't met or why you think additional conditions apply that staff did not think applied. That's what we need to hear because that's what we're really going to be making our decision on. We're basically checking off boxes based on did we hear evidence to satisfy that or not? And really everything you can do to help us follow your testimony and understand what criteria you're talking about will let your testimony be more effective. And we may personally agree, we may disagree with the opinions that you're stating, but most of that is just irrelevant. We can't act on our opinions, we're supposed to act on the law. And if we do act on our opinions rather than the law, that we're pretty sure that LUBA will send it right back to us. And we've all put a lot of time into reading this and we don't want to have to hear this issue again. So we're gonna be really careful about following the rules on this. So I also know it's very difficult for you to testify in this environment with with the Zoom link. Staff is going to be present and throughout this, Jonathan's going to be monitoring the room and he's going to be seeing if any of you raise your hands. And then they're going to group them up. So we're not going to interrupt in the middle if you raise your hand while someone's speaking, but we will get to you so that we will be able to hear from you. We do want to know if you have objections to the proceedings. Legal objections need to be heard. And we also need to know if people who haven't signed up wish to speak. So we'll give you a chance to do that. So let's move on.
Arthur, before you move on, I'm sorry to interrupt. There is a hand raised. You want to address it right now?
Yes, yeah, that's a perfect time. So it sounds like we're in the procedural steps and we're trying to explain procedures. So does someone wish to see Allison McDonald has raised her hand. Allison, would you like to ask us a question?
Yes, I would. And I think it's to Dan Kearns. What about the stream? Aren't there any rules about riparian areas, the protection of the nature, the environment, etc.?
Great. Thank you, Allison. And so we've got two experts on that. We've got Dan, who is our attorney and can answer that question while he's still here. And then I know that Jennifer is going to be addressing that during her staff report. But Dan, as long as the question was asked now, could you comment?
Yes. If it relates to the clear and objective, non-discretionary aspect of this proceeding, typically compliance with the local Goal 5 inventory, stream protections, riparian protections, those are generally not discretionary. They're pretty clear and objective. So I don't see that they fall into the category, but the rule still applies for needed housing. The decision cannot be discretionary. And that typically means goes to the housing aspect itself or the type of development that you're doing. And a good example of a discretionary criterion is consistent with the character of the neighborhood, where that would be totally discretionary, not allowed as a consideration for this matter. Compliance with riparian protections, those are typically pretty quantitative. Either there's riparian vegetation that's protected or it's not. It's not a discretionary matter.
Great, and so we know that Jennifer is going to address the non-discretionary elements of that in her presentation, which is going to come shortly. Any other hands, Jonathan? Oh, I see Mark Van Miller.
Yep, I'm gonna give Mark.
Mark Van Miller, you have the floor.
Thank you. Question about Dan mentioned needed housing, and my question is, does that imply some medium income level for, or is just any housing, needed housing in Hood River?
I told you that was going to come up, Dan.
Yes. It doesn't have anything to do with income level. It's defined pretty broadly. Let me pull up the definition. To mean needed housing means housing types determined to meet the need shown for housing within an urban growth boundary at particular price ranges and rent levels, including at least the following types. So attached and detached single-family housing and multifamily housing for both owner and renter occupancy. So that's the category this is in. It is deemed by the city in this comprehensive plan and its various planning documents that single-family housing, detached and attached, is needed to meet its housing demand. And so it fits the definition of needed housing without reference to a particular income level. So I think you're referring to affordable housing. I think if this, I mean, that's maybe a category of needed housing, but what's before you, as I understand, is not an affordability type category. It is single family, it's attached single family. So it meets the definition under state law for needed housing.
Dan, would it be fair to say that if it's identified under housing needs analysis, it is therefore needed housing?
Yes. Yeah, so to meet our goal 10.
The same term. Yeah.
Right. Our goal, it meets our goal 10 housing. Need for housing.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, just for a quick citation, I believe legal counsel is reading from ORS 303 and 307 of the state statutes for reference.
I thought he knew this off the top of his head. He was actually reading.
No, something. Actually, I was also the Goal 10 rule in Oregon Administrative Rules 660-008-005 definitions.
Okay, Mark, did that answer your question?
It did.
Okay, and AJ Kidd has raised his hand. I guess I don't have to go into the chat room to see this. AJ, staff, can you, Jonathan, AJ is there. Go ahead, AJ.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. I just want a clarification on something that Dan said about requiring the applicant to make offsite improvements I know that the some of the criteria, conditional, some of the conditions are to install sidewalk offsite. Can you explain? I don't know. Can you reconcile that, please? Maybe I have a misunderstanding.
Sure. As a general matter, I said offsite improvements are oftentimes subject to constitutional challenges. So these would be improvements that deal with deficiencies, oftentimes intersection deficiencies that are pre-existing and are not caused by a particular development. If this development can't be served by pedestrian access, for example, in those instances, we can require completion of these connections, though we have to go through a relatively minor constitutional analysis. The big ticket items, though, the offsite improvements, build a street that's offsite, build out an intersection that's offsite, those are the nature of transportation improvements that are typically and in general not allowed due to constitutional prohibitions.
So Dan, if you could just finish that, because we have proportionate share discussions in this report. So I would assume that proportionate shares get around that prohibition.
Right. That proportionate share is akin to systems development charges as well. And those are charges imposed on development because of they're legislatively imposed, legislatively adopted after a hearing. And so those are, it's already been determined that there is a direct causal connection between the trips generated by a particular development site and transportation, offsite transportation improvements that are needed. And so that direct causal connection has legislatively been determined. So that's kind of, again, I sort of hedge when I said generally these are prohibited. That's one of the exceptions for requiring offsite type improvements.
Thank you. AJ, was your question answered?
Yes, it was. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else have questions before we move on? Okay, well, let's move on then. So we've gone through the qualifications, disqualifications, and next is the staff report. So Jennifer, it's going to be yours for a little while now. And so everyone, please listen very carefully. Jennifer is going to outline how staff made its recommendation. So this is if you want to make comments to us, this is a great thing to start taking notes on and tell us what you got right and what you got wrong. Thank you. Jennifer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you.
Okay. Well, as the chairman mentioned, you've had my staff report and I trust you've all had a chance to read it. So I will attempt to provide some highlights and recap the staff report rather than go through page by page. The subject site is zoned R3, which is our high density residential zone in Hood River. And the proposal includes a multifamily housing project operated as a co-housing community. The use is a permitted use subject to site plan review, which has been discussed a little bit tonight. And as the planning director mentioned, he chose to bring the matter before you because we knew that there were a number of people interested in the project. And judging by the number of attendees tonight and the number of comments I've received over the course of the last couple months, I think that was probably the right choice. there's a number of issues I want to highlight that are addressed in the staff report. First of all, there were some questions raised about whether the application itself was complete and ready for review. And as explained in the staff report and in correspondence with the applicant and with neighbors who submitted comments of concern, state statute requires that if the applicant decides they are not interested in providing any additional information that the staff has requested for completeness, we are obligated to then review the application based on what we have. So in following state statute, we deem the application complete. there are some items that have been raised as concern by neighbors of the project in which we don't have authority to impose any additional conditions. An example of that is to provide guest or event parking, and our code does not provide for an ability for staff to require any parking beyond what is typically required for a multifamily project. The site plan review criteria, and actually before I get into that, I'll mention that the chairman mentioned there are many sections of the code that are applicable to the application tonight that I analyzed in the findings that are in the report, is on the website and that has been available for a week. Those sections include section 1703030, which is the high density residential zone standards. There are supplementary provisions in section 1704 of the municipal code. The site plan review criteria are included in municipal code section 1716, subsection 040. Landscaping requirements are included in chapter 1717. Transportation, circulation, and access management standards are included in chapter 1720. And the natural resource overlay for streams and wetlands are included in chapter 1722. In addition, there are procedural requirements for matters brought before Planning Commission, which we call quasi-judicial actions, and those are in 1709. So those are the chapters of the code that were reviewed and included in my findings. What I'll focus on tonight are the site plan review criteria. There are, I think, seven or eight site plan review criteria. The first one relates to natural features. It requires that applicants provide a design that protects natural features on a site to the maximum extent feasible. On this site, there's a stream. There are three identified wetlands and seeps, and there are steep slopes. There are also numerous native mature trees, which we call significant trees. The applicant has provided a design and information about the design that seeks to demonstrate that they have proposed a project layout that preserves those natural features to the extent feasible. I've included in my staff report recommendations for a number of conditions of approval that relate to natural features, such as requiring that a tree protection plan be provided to demonstrate how the trees that are proposed to be retained will be protected during construction, propose a final grading plan that minimizes grading on steep slopes to the extent feasible, and more minor condition to remove any remaining invasive vegetation on the site. And I know some of that work has already begun. The second site plan review criteria relates to grading. And the criteria is that there is no adverse effect from grading on neighboring properties, public right-of-way, or public storm drainage system. I would note that the creek on the site that is identified as Adams Creek is part of our public storm drainage system. So it is both a stream and a public storm facility. The engineering department has provided comments related to grading and natural features and provided a number of conditions of approval that are recommended, and those have been included in the staff report. The applicant, as I mentioned, needs to demonstrate that there's no adverse effect on neighboring properties, public rights of way, or the public storm drainage system. As noted in the staff report, the stormwater management plan submitted by the applicant is very preliminary in nature, and concerns were raised by the engineering department and planning staff during the completeness review phase about the adequacy of the preliminary plan. I'll talk about that a little bit more later, but it is something that we might want to discuss further as the meeting goes on tonight. The third site plan review criteria relates to adequate public facilities that are needed to demonstrate that there are adequate public facilities such as streets, utilities, to serve the project. And this is something that was discussed a little bit this evening by the attorney and questions that came up about sidewalks. Again, the engineering department provided comments specific to adequate public facilities, including utilities and utility easements, rights of way of existing streets, frontage improvements, proportionate shares for intersections that are affected by the project, and sidewalk improvements. As explained in detail in the staff report, we've included conditions of approval related to some of these public facilities because they are not currently adequate to serve the project as proposed. Some of those conditions include additional right-of-way dedication along Sherman Avenue and Adams Creek Place, and frontage improvements, particularly along Sherman Avenue and Adams Creek Place, proportionate share for intersection improvements at five intersections that are identified in the staff report, and as noted earlier, sidewalk improvements along Eugene Street. The sidewalk improvements were identified as providing adequate pedestrian facilities to the peripheral street system, which is a standard in the municipal code. So all of these conditions do relate back to code provisions, and I'm happy to answer any questions about those. A fourth criteria for site plan review relates to traffic analysis, and there was pretty extensive explanation in the staff report as to why a traffic analysis letter was required of the applicant as opposed to a traffic impact analysis. There's also discussion in the staff report about why the city is requiring that the vehicular access for the proposed project is from local streets instead of a collector street. The site has frontage on Sherman Avenue as well as what is currently an unnamed right-of-way that is proposed to be called Adams Creek Place, and that's a local street. Our transportation system plan and the city code require that when there's frontage in more than one street, that access be taken from the lesser classification street. That's to promote increased mobility and traffic flow on our higher classification streets, such as collectors and arterials, and to avoid any, the code minimizes the number of driveways and increases the spacing between driveways on collectors and arterials to keep traffic flowing more freely on those streets, and with a preference toward providing more access, driveway type access off of the local streets. You'll see a condition of approval recommended in the staff report that that reiterates that requirement by explicitly prohibiting vehicular access from the existing driveway off of Sherman Avenue. There are other criteria for site plan review that relate to outdoor storage and mechanical equipment. Those are pretty straightforward. You've seen many times before on other applications, so I'm not going to go into detail about that. There is a design criteria that has some clear and objective standards to be met. One of the standards was not clearly demonstrated as being met in the project materials that were submitted, and that was the standard about not having an uninterrupted facade length of greater than 100 feet. There's a condition related to demonstrating that that standard is met for the garage / carport building. Other issues that I identified and are of interest, I think, for you tonight, I did mention the pedestrian linkage to the peripheral street system. as being the basis for the requirement for sidewalk improvements along Eugene Street. It's also the basis for the staff recommendation that a pedestrian linkage be provided at the southeast corner of the site to allow pedestrians to connect from this site to Andy's Way and farther south to key interest points in the city, including the Hood River Middle School, the Aquatic Center, and Jackson Park. The city has block length and perimeter standards that are not met in this area of town. This is a great opportunity to make a very small but significant improvement to the pedestrian linkage in this neighborhood. And that is the reason for including that condition of approval. And it relates back to provision 1720.030B4. As explained on page 34 of my staff report. I included additional detail on page 37 of my staff report about prohibiting continued use of vehicular access on the driveway on Sherman Avenue and suggesting that maybe some bollards or other provision be included there. And I go into the staff report adds further detail about the vehicular access off of Eugene and Adams Creek Place on page 41 of the staff report. And then another issue that was that is significant in the staff report and was brought up many times in comments received from neighbors are the provisions related to wetland and stream protection. When we did a pre-application conference with the applicant on this project, we recommended that the applicant conduct a wetland investigation, knowing that there was a stream on the site. And the applicant did do that and went ahead and performed a wetland delineation. You have a copy of that in the packet. We received a concurrence letter from the Oregon Department of State Lands concurring with the delineation of the wetlands and the stream and associated seeps. The city does not require a buffer for wetlands, even when they are deemed significant. And the city does not require a buffer for streams that are not deemed significant. Significant streams in Hood River are fish-bearing streams, and they're pretty limited to the Columbia River and Indian Creek, and there may be one more. But Adams Creek is not identified as a significant stream under the city's Goal 5 and Natural Resource Protection. There was a comment submitted that noted that one of the plans from the civil engineering plan submitted shows a sewer line going through one of the seeps. The applicant has made the case that they are not impacting any wetlands or streams identified on the site with any of the development. So that might be something you want to ask the applicant to explain further. But in summary, there are no significant wetlands or streams identified on the site. And so the city does not restrict, does not add any restrictions or buffers. The state, however, does identify these waters as waters of the state, and they are subject to state requirements for permits for any filling or grading impacts greater than 50 cubic feet. So there are conditions of approval related to compliance with state law, but the city does not have specific protection measures that are applicable in this case. Just to sort of recap and provide a general overview of what you saw in my staff report. The applicant is proposing, as we've said, 25 dwelling units in three buildings with additional associated accessory buildings to serve the multifamily use. It is a permitted use in the R3 zone. The density that is proposed, they are not maxing out the number of units that would be allowed on the site. The density that is proposed is comparable to the Cady's Lane planned unit development to the south. As noted earlier, the city has documented that multifamily housing is in fact, the city is deficient in multifamily housing, and it is in fact needed housing that's recognized under state law. And along to that end, we've included recommended conditions of approval that we think are applicable in order to meet the standards. So while it's needed housing, the applicant does still need to demonstrate compliance with the standards. And as I mentioned earlier, this site is potentially a little bit complicated from what you might see on a flat site with no water or few mature trees. And so that there are a number of conditions of approval included. I wanted to go back to what I started to discuss earlier about the stormwater plan. The engineering department did raise concerns, and that's included in my staff report, that it was not clear that the preliminary stormwater plan was demonstrating that the plan will meet the code of not having any adverse impact on particularly the public storm system, but also on neighboring properties. We did request additional information during the completeness review phase of the project and did not receive any additional, any revised or updated storm plan other than some verbal assurances that it would meet the plan. One thing that the Planning Commission can consider is requesting a revised preliminary stormwater plan that demonstrates the ability to meet the code with the project layout as proposed. So the question that the engineering department couldn't answer to planning staff was, will there need to be significant changes to the site layout in order to meet the stormwater requirements? And that's a little bit of an unknown. So there are a couple options. You may want to request that they demonstrate that yes, they can provide a stormwater plan without significant changes to the site layout. Or you may want to alter the conditions of approval that would ensure that if there are significant changes to the site layout, that an approval, if you decide to approve the application tonight, may have to be amended in order to, if there are significant changes to the site layout, or if there are in fact impacts to streams and wetlands that aren't shown tonight in the materials before you. That's something that the applicant can address this evening in greater detail. But other than that, I think I will leave it to you to ask me questions, and we can dive deeper into any of the topics that are included in my staff report.
Okay, thank you very much, Jennifer. So where we are, we've heard staff report, and what we do next is we allow commissioners to ask questions. I'll just remind the commissioners that we're not beginning deliberations. We don't do that until after we've heard public testimony. So please ask your questions in the form of a question. But if you have questions on Jennifer's report, please go ahead. Mark.
Hey, Jennifer. I have a question. It actually already came up, I think, by Daniel, the attorney, but about compatibility. I think some of the written testimony talked about compatibility. I don't see a lot written in the staff report about compatibility with the R1 neighborhood. There is a design thing that you mentioned about 150 or 100 feet being broken up. But can you explain, is there, you know, any discretion or code that we are, you know, beholden to around compatibility?
No, in fact, I'm glad you asked that question because we used to have a criteria in our site plan review section that did talk about compatibility. And several years ago, the state asked us to update our code to comply with state law to take out those discretionary subjective standards as they would relate to needed housing. So our code has been updated to take that criterion out, and it's not something that we addressed explicitly in the staff report. I will add that this is a significant change from what is currently developed on the site, a single family dwelling. It is a significant change for the neighbors who live on Eugene Street and the increased traffic that's expected with this project. However, local streets are designed to accommodate 1,000 to 1,200 trips per day. And this project does not take that that traffic load beyond what a local street can accommodate. So there are some things that I think you will hear from people who are testifying tonight about compatibility. We have some specific criteria and measurements for what are the capacity of streets, for example, are, and tried to address those in the findings and conditions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Mark, are you, do you have further questions? Bill, your turn.
Sure. Through all, and this might be a question for Stoner or Dan or Jennifer, through all of the traffic impact analysis, all that was performed at, I guess, the operating state of the project. And I'm wondering what ability or how we should view impacts that are during the construction phase of the project.
Stoner, you can jump in if you have anything additional, but in the zoning code, we don't have any specific standards or criteria that relate to construction impacts. And I'm not sure if there are any specific to a construction site permit that's administered through Public Works and Engineering.
We do have, excuse me, I'm fritzing out here. We do have some criteria, not really traffic related per se. It's mostly time of work and noise and things like that. It's related to construction in the engineering standards. Also, we call it 1200C permit, which is issued by the state, which is an erosion control permit for during construction activities. But not really a criteria for truck traffic. Typically, there's a mob where they'll mob all their equipment in, and then they leave the equipment on site. And then after the site development's done, then the construction of the actual facilities, which there'd be a little bit, probably you'd see a little bit more activity as far as vehicles with, you know, framers and then through the finishing process of the building. But they would be, you know, like vans mostly.
Okay. Thank you.
I have.
Keep going.
I have two houses under construction at the end of my street, and there's 20 trucks there, and these are single family residents. So I'm just, that's why I was kind of asking that question, and what rules apply during the construction of this, and maybe that's related to this hearing or conditions or related to some other public works function. Any
okay.
more comments on that or no? Stoner.
Okay, sorry, I guess I missed the question there.
Well, I guess the question would be, is there any ability to, any requirement to try and keep construction vehicles on site versus off site on public streets or not?
Well, I would think with this project, there'd be a lot of opportunity to do that in just requiring that, a good portion of the site work would be done. There's a parking lot that would be part of that. As far as like our legal ability to condition that, maybe Jennifer would have a better understanding of that since Dan's gone.
I think we'd benefit from hearing from the applicant what their proposal is.
Okay. Bill, do you have further questions?
No.
We'll take that one as kind of unresolved. Anyone else? Any other commissioners?
I have,
Sue, go ahead.
I have two separate questions. One is the ingress and egress for vehicles traffic on from Eugene. And I'm just wondering, at what point does a housing development, a multifamily housing development, need to have two points of access or ingress and egress? What's the criteria for that? That's one question. And then totally separate from that, on the wetland delineation, I guess the state concurred that there are indeed wetlands on the air, on the grounds. And what makes a wetland significant? What's the criteria or the definition of that? These apparently are not significant wetlands. Is that my understanding? Is that right?
The applicant provided some analysis related to that. That's in the packet. The criteria that are used to determine significance are in the Oregon administrative rules. And based on the applicant's analysis provided by a wetland specialist, it did not meet all of the criteria to be deemed significant.
Okay.
And your first question was for Stoner, I believe?
Yeah, the first question I'm not sure the answer to.
Okay. I got focused on the wetland. So it's a combination of flora and soil type, and there's a few other conditions as well. And if it doesn't meet all that criteria, it won't be considered significant. Back to the street question, the transportation. I think you're alluding to a level of service that a development would impact. Is that right?
I just want to understand the access requirements, the ingress and egress.
Oh, okay, so right. So typically, and that is the two points of access is typically kind of required through the fire code on whether it needs two accesses. It's a fire life safety type issue in general. I don't believe this development is near that size. And if we had Leonard here, he might be able to comment to that.
Okay. Any other questions, Sue?
No, I'm good.
Any other commissioners have questions? Megan, you just showed up again. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I muted my video because I was afraid my bandwidth was low. My question is for Jennifer. She mentioned the pre-application conference and the riparian study that the application did, and that seemed to be not a requirement or a standard that they were meeting, but more. Was that more of goodwill? And are there other areas that the applicant has exceeded standards, requirements, or criteria in their application?
I believe the Oregon Department of State Lands required the wetland delineation. In answer to that question. So no, I can't think of areas where the applicant has exceeded requirements.
Okay, and then quickly to follow up the transportation system plan. I didn't see this in the staff report. Calls for what we used to call the bike boulevard on Prospect, Eugene. I'm totally blanking. Yeah, to cut through the middle school.
Was that at all a consideration in this application and connecting that key east-west corridor?
I'll have to take a look at that. While we're hearing public testimony, let me take a look and see if I'm not, I think you're talking about on Sherman Avenue?
Not Sherman, it's through Katie's Lane into Eugene, I believe, but let me make, I have to look at a map.
Hopefully Jennifer or Kevin can take a look at that as we move on and get back to you before we continue, before we go too much further down. Do you have any other questions, though?
No, thank you.
Tina, Erica, do you have any questions? I'm going to take that as a no. You're muted, nope. Tina, but I think you're saying no. Okay. I've got a few simple ones. Number one, Jennifer, you stated that in terms of density, that this project is similar in density to Katie's Lane. Do you mean, is that, how are you measuring that? Is that simply number of dwellings per acre?
Yes. I have some rough calculations that I could share with you. The proposal is either 25 or 26 dwelling units on approximately 2.36 acres, which is either 10.6 or 11 units per acre, depending on whether you include the guest suite in the common house. Katie's Lane is approximately 23 units on 2.2 acres, or about 10 and a half units per acre.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question. I saw a comment that talked about this zoning of having an R3 next to an R1 as being an anomaly, that in general you expect R1 next to R2 next to R3. Can you comment on both, is that the case in Hood River, and is that a requirement? Is there any special treatment that R3 would get in a situation where it borders on R1 versus on R2 or some other zone?
No, there's no special treatment. If you were starting with a clean slate, that's probably how you would graduate the zoning. This zoning has been in place for many decades, and there are other places in town where R1 is adjacent to R3. I'd have to take a look at the map when I'm not looking at a Zoom screen. So again, while there's public testimony, I believe over on the east side of town, there's R1 next to R3.
Like right behind my house.
Right. There are no specific transition requirements in the code.
So I have a question about stormwater. And so I talked to Dan about this for a little while, and he said that, because clearly there's a question as to whether the applicant has provided adequate stormwater plans yet. And staff has decided to, or has proposed putting a requirement in that that they don't get to move forward until they provide plans that have been reviewed by engineering and found to be acceptable. So the question is, as if we are to allow them to move forward with the current lack of plans for stormwater, or the current minimal plans for stormwater, the question is, does engineering believe that it is feasible to resolve the stormwater needs of this project within this site plan?
Before Stoner talks, let me just clarify one thing, and that's that the city will not issue permits, construction site permit or building permit, until the applicant has demonstrated that the standards are met. So right. The question really becomes, when the applicant provides the final stormwater plan during the permitting phase through engineering, will that result in some significant changes to the site layout that you're seeing tonight? And we're not quite sure of the answer. And I think what you'll hear Stoner say is that we don't necessarily need the final stormwater plan to make that determination, at least in concept. But what we have before you for the preliminary plan does not clearly, at least conceptually, demonstrate that.
And I understand all of that. The reason I asked the question is Dan expressed that the standard which should be considered at this preliminary phase is a feasibility standard.
Right.
That we don't have the final plan, so Stoner can't determine whether it meets the requirements and therefore is not going to issue a building permit until he gets that. But we should not be going forward, or should we be going forward, if we don't believe it's feasible. So the question is feasibility, and I'm wondering if he has an opinion on feasibility.
I think there's enough uncertainty of that question that that's why we're raising it, but I'll let Stoner add to that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had concerns about the plaza section and what was proposed to us. And as the record shows, we expressed those in comments. We met with the applicant's engineer, and he assured us that they could still do it. We said, "Well, we're not quite so sure," but they, basically proposed verbally several ways that they thought they could achieve it. That was different than what was shown on the plans that we received. After that meeting, we suggested that they resubmit a plan that kind of showed what they were talking about with the detention calculations for what they, there was a couple of scenarios they proposed. But to be honest, Mr. Chairman, the engineering department is still concerned that they can feasibly mitigate that plaza section without altering something up in the plaza area. Okay. So that has been a concern, still is. But they chose to proceed forward with going to this public meeting.
Okay. And my final question, I appreciate that. I understand the complicated position you're in. I think that's the exact answer. That answers the question precisely. My final question is concerning antiquities protection. I promised I was going to ask this. Is there a standard that requires compliance with state and federal antiquities protection during the construction phase of this project? I assume that, obviously they're under state and federal law, but do we specifically cite that given the historic nature? This is where the first European settlement in Hood River was, as well as native habitation for millennia before that.
No, we don't typically add that in, but we could add in a condition as a reminder to the applicant that they are subject to state and federal law in that regard. It's not specifically a city requirement.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm done with my questions. Did I prompt any questions from anybody else? Any other commissioners want questions before we move on to the applicant? Megan.
Just a clarification on my question to Jennifer and Kevin is that the bike boulevard or the neighbor way is, if you follow me, from the county building on 6th and State, it travels up Serpentine and turns into Eugene, which turns into Park, which turns into Montello, goes through Katie's Lane and is supposed to travel south to connect through the middle school. And so my question, just to clarify, was that neighbor way or bike boulevard a consideration in your in the pedestrian connection to Eugene? And is there any way to make that pedestrian connection a multi-use path?
Okay, thank you for clarifying that, and hopefully we'll get an answer on that later. Any other questions before we go on to the applicant? Okay, now would be the time where we hear the applicant. Any comments the applicant wishes to make explaining their project, explaining how they meet the approval criteria. So Johnson, can you do that?
Sure.
And while we're doing that, I see that we do have a hand raised. So I'm hoping that that's a procedural question as opposed to a substantive question. Can you allow Seth to ask his question?
Yes.
Thank you. And Seth, you're muted. So I think you can unmute yourself now.
Thank you. Yeah, this is Seth. I am the architect and representative for the applicant tonight and providing the applicant presentation.
That would be why you raised your hand. Okay, so you're not asking us procedural questions. Thank you very much. The floor is yours.
All right, thank you.
Let me promote you, Seth, before you start. Do you have a presentation visual?
I do.
Okay, let me promote you to panelist, then you can present that as well. Okay, Seth, you are a panelist and you may share your screen now.
Seth, you might be on mute if you're talking.
Yeah, it looks like I was remuted. Can everyone hear me?
Oh, we hear you now.
We can hear you now.
Okay, excellent. And everyone can confirm that they can see the slide on the screen.
We can see the slide. Thank you.
Again, my name is Seth Moran, and I'm an architect with the design team for Adams Creek Co-Housing. And I'd like to start by thanking the planning staff and the commission and the members of the Hood River community who are participating tonight in this important public forum. As a contributor to the application for this site plan review, in this presentation, I'm going to elaborate on the proposal, the approval criteria that Jennifer referenced, and then how the proposal is meeting those criteria. I also believe it's important to understand that this project is not viewed just from a procedural viewpoint, but as a contributing element to the fabric of the greater Hood River community. It's a unique program, co-housing, and so rather than me explain it, I'd like to explain the vision behind the formation of Adams Creek Co-Housing. And to do that, I'm going to turn over the presentation over to founding member Jim Miller.
It actually would be helpful, Seth, if you could let us know who we should be promoting to the panel, who's going to be working on the presentation with you so we can get them all done at once.
If you see a name, Jim Miller, or perhaps if Jim would just raise his hand.
Jim has been promoted.
Okay, is there anyone else who you want to add while we're at it?
Nope, that would be it. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
All right, so Jim Miller, I live at 724 Prospect Avenue here in Hood River. And I'm a founder of Adams Creek Co-Housing. So it all started not long after the birth of our second child. After a series of sleepless nights and a family too far away to help, Nashir and I started to ask ourselves, isn't there a better way to live? As an Oregon native, but new to Hood River at the time, we didn't have any real support structure. Our neighbors were great, but our interactions were limited. We certainly couldn't ask them to come over and watch a newborn for hours as we shopped or caught up with sleep. We're mostly alone. I don't think our story is much different than many parents with young kids. We needed community. We needed support. That continued quest to find a better way to live would eventually lead us to co-housing. We're drawn by the vibrant, multi-generational communities and practicality of shared meals. We wanted land for our kids to play, but didn't want the upkeep of a large property. Most of all, we wanted connection. If you've read anything about co-housing, you will recognize the name Chuck Durrett. Chuck is credited with bringing the concept from Denmark over 40 years ago and literally wrote the book on modern co-housing. We studied his work and started to dialogue with him. The concept was compelling to us. We just didn't know if there'd be any other like-minded people in the local community. In the spring of 2016, we decided to take a chance, hired Chuck, and rented the Columbia Center for the Arts for him to give a presentation. Our marketing skills and budget were modest, but much to our surprise, about 110 people showed up that night. In the weeks that followed, we reached out to those interested and shared dinners at our house. The enthusiasm was incredible, and we clearly had struck a nerve. Not only had people in the Gorge heard of co-housing, but the support for our community here was strong. We started meeting weekly at the Hood River Library. We organized a search committee, outreach events, and tried to get familiar with the development process. None of us had experience developing property prior to this project. We also had to learn to start educating ourselves. We also didn't know each other well, so we arranged potlucks and retreats to have some fun and become better acquainted. It was also a time to learning how to work within a consent governance model and build skills in nonviolent communication. You often hear about how hard it is for a couple to build a common home. We were about to embark on an adventure to build an entire community and within a structure that needed everyone to agree. Would that even be possible? Our first big struggle was finding land. We talked with many local builders, knocked on many doors, we searched everywhere. The problem was always a zoning. Lots that were large enough just didn't allow the density we needed. And finding any land that wasn't already tied up was challenging. We'd spend the next 2 years looking. Near the end of that time, the group actually broke up for a period of time, disillusioned and tired of not making progress. We needed an R3 property, the perfect zoning for a project like ours. Then came the Akiyama property and our fortune started to change. Presenting here today has only been possible through thousands of hours of hard work by our community that I'm here to represent. This is an incredible group of people, and what defines us is much more than a set of structures. Tonight, I will talk us through some of our core values as they relate to co-housing and bring context to the plans we're about to discuss. And while I won't go through the complete set of values, I will focus on just three germane to key elements of our design. First value is we recognize that relationships are the core of our community and foster friendship and connection by creating traditions and opportunities for sharing and spontaneous fun. A core design tenet for co-housing is to create opportunities for interaction. This manifests in so many aspects of our design. For example, co-housing projects push parking to the side of the project and create a walkable lane through the core of the community. This creates a safe place for children to play and adults to interact as they enter the property. The density of the project also helps encourage interaction because conversations are comfortable within the individual homes. Shared property, including our common house, allows us to come together for shared meals, activities, celebration, as well as the collaborative work required to care for them. Our second value is we respect the balance between privacy and interconnection. This is another key design element of co-housing. We live our lives in a balance between the needs for time of high and low social interaction. Co-housing is not co-living. Each person in the community owns their own home. And while we want to create opportunities for interaction, we also highly value our own private space. Third value is we value responsible stewardship, walking lightly on the land and making day-to-day choices that support environmental sustainability. This third value works particularly well for co-housing communities. In fact, many of the co-housing communities around the nation identify as eco-villages. By living in community, sharing resources, and designing for lower energy use helps us reduce our impact. And as a direct result of this value, we design this community from the beginning to be net zero ready. It's also important to note that we have deliberately set aside the creek area for green space. And since this is a community-focused development without a profit motive, we don't need to bury the creek to maximize the buildable land. What that means for the project is 55% of the land reserved for green space. Code requires 20%. We are nearly five times the requirement in surely a Hood River record for multifamily projects. Further, allocating the parking near the street entrance means that the project requires a fraction of the asphalt and concrete of a traditional R3 project. Look no further than most of the multifamily developments in town and compare the amount of paving required versus our project. So I conclude tonight by using a quote from the National Co-Housing Association. When asked why co-housing, they say so many reasons. In a way, it comes down to making the world a better place. Connection, environmentalism, security, and community support all draw neighbors to co-housing communities. We stay because we love our neighbors, the lifestyle we share, and the growth we experience. It is stated in the city goals that we need to diversify our housing stock in Hood River, and I can't imagine a better way than a locally led, funded, and vibrant co-housing community. The zoning is perfect for this project, and we have met, or in some cases, far exceeded all that has been asked of us. We look forward to your approval. I'll now pass the mic back to Seth to share the rest of the design.
All right, thank you, Joe. So let's start by establishing, at least graphically, some of the existing site conditions. So the parcel on this aerial view is identified in pink with a north-south orientation paralleling Adams Creek, which is roughly the dashed blue line. We already started to talk about the street network. So you can see here 13th Street, Sherman Avenue to the north, which is connected to 17th Street and then connected to Eugene Street, which we've established is the vehicular access to the site. As noted, Hazel and 16th are unimproved, as is a short section of gravel alley. It shows up on some maps as 14th Street. Here on this image, it's labeled alley. And we'll talk about that a bit more. Zoning for the parcel is R3. It's also known as urban high density residential. And as Jennifer noted, that boundary encompasses some properties immediately to the east and to the south. And that's that establishes the approval criteria for multifamily develop in an R3 zone. We already mentioned that Sherman is classified as a collector and Eugene is classified as a local street. And my understanding is that there are some specific city engineering standards better described in the staff report that explains why the vehicular access is actually not allowed via Sherman. For a bit of additional context, I've got a couple of street views. This first one is at Sherman. Again, that's the north edge of the site. To the left of this image is Adams Creek. And you can see the parallel existing driveway climbing the hill. This image is sort of a good illustration of the steepness of the site. Certainly any of you who have visited understand it much more intimately. Sherman climbs uphill to the west, and there's roughly about 40 feet of elevation difference from Sherman at that driveway connection to the upper portion of the site, which you can sort of see implied by the single family home that's currently on site. The terrain slopes similarly from the upper site downhill to the east to Adams Creek, and then back up similarly to the properties east of the creek. We talked about the tree density. This image gives you a sense of that. Certainly the creek and then the buffer from Sherman Avenue provide, you know, shading, habitat, and then also provides a buffer for the properties to the east of the creek. So in this view, we are now standing on Eugene, looking due east toward the southern half of the proposal site. The trees that you see along the horizon line, those are on the ridges to either side of Adams Creek. And then you can see that there are actually three existing homes directly adjacent to some portion of the site boundary, not including the creek buffer. And we're gonna look at two of those specific conditions later in the presentation. That's essentially this house here and this home to the north of Eugene. Okay, quick note for this slide and all the ones that are gonna follow, north has been rotated to the right. And that's really so we can just see more of the site on the screen. So everybody kind of shift your north arrow. We're looking to the right now for plan north. So this is a diagram of the existing site and it's color coded. So I think it's pretty clear, but the property line is dashed in red, Adams Creek and the wetlands in blue. The areas that surround those waterways, as well as the steepest terrain, are shaded in green. And then large diameter trees or the green circles. And then the pink shading represents the utility easements, property dedications, and building setbacks that are required per feedback received from the various city departments. And so as you can quickly see, that leaves about probably less than half of the site as a low impact zone for smart development. So this is the area that's already relatively flat, has already been cleared of dense stands of trees, and also already has the existing structures. So by our attempt to develop primarily in these areas is how the project meets many of the approval criteria. And I think this diagram also highlights perhaps the biggest challenge of this site, and that is the perceived conflict between allowed multifamily density that's desired by the city's smart density goals, respect for the unique natural conditions of the site, and then the more subjective impacts to adjacent property owners. Jennifer already elaborated on the maximum and proposed density on the site. But with that in mind, let's go ahead and look at the proposed site plan. Jennifer, I think, identified a number of the elements. You've had a chance to look through the site plan review submittal. So I'm just going to maybe highlight a few elements for reference point, because I'm sure there'll be many questions later. So Eugene Street, again, is coming in from the west. The vehicular entry into the site is directly aligned with Eugene Street, so incoming and outgoing traffic line with Eugene. The pretty much all of the parking, and I'll go over this in, as applicable to the review criteria, is to the southwest portion of the site. And then we have our three primary buildings in blue. So for reference, building one at 3 stories and 15 units. Building two is sort of the baby, 2 stories, 4 units. Building three, 1 unit wider, so that's also 2 stories at 6 units. Connecting the resident entries, which are all internal to the development, is what I'll refer to as the central greenway. And at the sort of head and tail of that greenway are 2 accessory buildings. The rec building is a simple 1-story building for bike storage, gardening supplies, things of that nature. It also contains the waste receptacles embedded or sort of concealed by the volume of that building. An entry plaza, the greenway, and then the heart of the community, which is the common house. The narrative that was provided, if you've read that, goes into great detail about what program is in that space, but essentially it is the shared common amenities that allows co-housing residents to downsize their living space. So one thing to note is that the average unit size of the 25 proposed dwelling units is actually considerably smaller than you might see in a single family proposal. We can come back to this at the end of the presentation if there are any specific questions or other features you'd like to discuss. So as part of this presentation, I'm going to show several marketing renderings. Just a quick word of caution, these are renderings, and while they are accurate in many ways, they also illustrate qualities, color being a good example, that are really not part of this review process. So this particular view, it's a floating view, like you might see from a low drone, and it's from the north edge of the site. It's not the street view from Sherman, which would be obscured by the steep terrain and the number of trees that you saw in the Google view. I'll just keep moving forward. Let's refresh our memories about the decision criteria for multifamily development. There's a great number of them in the staff report. I have simplified them here on the screen, and this will be the way I sort of talk about the rest of the presentation. This is in addition to the specific criteria, of course, of the zoning code, the setbacks, building heights, the things that are easy to measure. So there's a specific chapter dedicated to these approval criteria. And just to reiterate, the staff report takes no issue with how the proposal addresses these specific criteria in that chapter. But for the sake of clarity and understanding for all those who are participating, I'm going to go ahead and elaborate on a few of those. So let's start with public facilities. We talked about this a little bit during the introductory questions. So we're talking about water, sewer, storm, things like access to provide garbage collection, fire truck access, and of course the streets and the sidewalks. So the burden on the applicant is to provide adequate capacity. And through the site plan review process, the City of Hood River agencies have required that the applicant build and then pay for many upgrades to the public facilities. So those are listed on the right. That would be things like moving the vehicular access from Sherman to Eugene Street, upgrading that gravel alley that I referenced to a full width city street. And so from here forward, we're going to call that Adams Creek Place. That was the requested name for that roadway. The request from the city is to place a sidewalk along the north side of Eugene Street, as well as a new sidewalk, well, a sidewalk that doesn't exist, along the south side of Sherman, which will include some pedestrian crossing over Adams Creek itself. And then there's some property dedications, including the 20 feet to create the new roadway, dedication for the sidewalk on Sherman. There is an existing storm easement, which is also being widened to 20 feet. And then there is a brand new easement here, which serves a new water loop connection for the level of service needed to supply fresh water to the building. I think this is going to be a good time to acknowledge that the commission is likely to hear concerns about the impact of additional car trips on Eugene Street. I think Dan addressed that a little bit earlier. I guess in brief, a traffic impact letter was provided per those decision criteria, and it did find that Eugene Street does have adequate capacity for those trips. You had asked about some of the approach and feasibility of the stormwater system as proposed. We're talking about, for those listening in, the system for how rainwater, when it falls on the site, it's collected, detained, which is to say slowed down, and then released back to the natural condition, which in this case is Adams Creek. So two facilities are proposed, and one, as you can see here on the screen with my cursor, collects water from the parking area and plaza and holds the water in a detention pond until it's released. The second system is a series of swales that collect the rainwater from the roofs of the buildings and then distributes that water to a detention swale, so more linear, that then holds the water until it's released to Adams Creek. And to be clear, all stormwater that falls on the site is released to the creek slowly at a rate that is equal to or less than the historic pre-development condition. And the facilities themselves are sized for a 25-year storm event. Now there's a lot more details to that, which we can get into if there are questions. To the point of feasibility, I would say that most jurisdictions through which I and the team have experience request what is called a sort of conceptual level of engineering for a site plan review that's typically performed by staff. I think obviously the fact that this has been kicked up to the commission perhaps has elevated that threshold a little bit. As Stoner Bell referenced, the project engineer and the city engineer did speak and discuss some of these feasibility concerns. And my understanding is that the engineer has the utmost confidence that any adjustments that might be required as the engineers get into the nuance, the fine-grained details of the strategy, would not lead to any significant changes to this proposal. Maybe one example of that would be there are always options to put some of the detention capacity underground or to distribute in a way that isn't quite so singular, like the one detention pond shown near the parking. I don't know if this is an appropriate point to take questions related to this topic, or if I should continue to proceed with the presentation.
You can certainly, I'm sorry, did you, hold on a second, sorry. My screen just disappeared, so let me just try to find you again, but you're certainly welcome to stop now if you want to ask for questions.
Let's go ahead and keep going. We can always come back to this slide.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you. All right, so natural features and landscaping, and this is really important because protecting natural features to the, quote, maximum extent feasible is not just a city requirement, it's a value of the community. I don't know if Jim referenced this in his intro, but the creek was a really fundamental factor in the community's decision to purchase this property. And what you see in this proposal is a strategy for appropriate density and to be maybe lighter on the land. It's more about a commitment to not develop over the top of the creek. It's a commitment to stewardship. So protect the creek, remove invasive plants, and restore that habitat. Jim mentioned this, but I think it's really important. The R3 zone, as written, accommodates far more roads, more parking, and more building footprint than the area that's required to be preserved for landscaping. So again, you know, 20% requirement in this project is providing over 55% of green space. And certainly some of that area is the existing condition. It's already dense, it's got natural vegetation, but that aside, the proposal still provides far more landscaping and less concrete than you would see in a conventional development. I don't want to reduce this proposal for multi-story buildings to a simple necessity of the site. There are many benefits for having a very compact layout and multi-story buildings. For example, the proposed siding and the massing of the buildings is important to the co-housing principle of supporting strong community interaction. So COVID aside, chance encounters between residents are going to happen face-to-face, and that's why this well-connected network of pedestrian pathways are so important to a co-housing community, really to all communities. And this slide identifies the on-site walkways dashed in pink, including that very important pedestrian greenway that connects all of the building entries. And there's a snippet of that image on the bottom left. But equally important are those public sidewalks on Sherman Avenue, Adams Creek Place, and Eugene Street. So also brought up and noted on the far left of this image is a connection, a possible connection to Andes Way. Currently it's a informal sort of cut through path that leads to the, I believe it's Andes Way is the street name beyond, and then that connects to Hood River Middle School. And that's predominantly the population that's using the pathway that exists. Yes, it was clear that the city planning staff has a preference for that connection and that it be made permanent. We also heard considerable concern from the adjacent neighbors about loitering and similar concerns. And so we don't have to talk about this right now, but the applicant does request the commission's feedback and recommendation to either include or omit this connection. The connection, by the way, is I would estimate a grade difference of maybe 5 or 6 feet from the parking area to the property beyond the southern edge. So that's just something to keep in mind. Okay, so two other key approval criteria that have to do with the placement and the orientation of the parking and the buildings. The first is to locate parking behind buildings or to the sides, which we've clearly done. And then locate buildings toward the street rather than the parking. And this criteria reinforces, and to some extent, the placement of building one, which is along and, you know, parallel fronting directly the street, Adams Creek Place. So both of these criteria, as you can see, have some impacts to adjacent properties. And I'd next like to take a closer look at two conditions. This first is a connection, or sorry, a section diagram through the single story house, 1419 Eugene Street, and then through the carport boundary of the parking area. So the design strategy that we've employed here and sort of augmented with having received some additional comments from the neighborhood is to take advantage of our cut and fill for that parking area to lower its elevation. This diagram kind of represents a series of conditions between the two properties, but generally speaking, it's, you know, anywhere from a foot or two to maybe 4 or 5 feet lower. And that places the vehicles and the parking lower than the line of sight from the house and certainly its fenced rear yard. And then we're also using a solid wall of the carport to further screen any views of parked cars. And that wall, where it exists, would be softened with a landscape setback. And of course, that setback extends beyond the carport itself as a visual buffer for the benefit of this property owner, but also those that might be looking down Eugene Street. All right, excuse me. This next diagram is a section through Adams Creek Place with the two-story house at 1422 Eugene on the left-hand side and proposed building one on the right-hand side. I want to acknowledge that for this property owner and any of you who have walked the site, we certainly understand that the perceived mass of building one is a concern. And that's understandable simply because when you stand in that gravel alley and you try to imagine what you've read on paper is a three-story building, that would be concerning to anyone, even myself. But what is not apparent when you're on the site is that the right-of-way is being increased by 20 feet. So starting with the property line of the neighbor, the current property line, which is actually not even the extent of the gravel alley currently, is roughly 20 feet away. And then as a requirement of creating Adams Creek Place, we are dedicating 20 feet of property along that edge to create a new property line, to which then is applied the criteria for a setback and landscaping buffer for the building. So property line to property line, we're looking at about 40 feet as recommended by the city engineer, and a rough estimate of building plane to building plane for the structures new and existing is around 60 feet away. And of course, this buffer, I think it's softened by, you know, a sidewalk, street trees, the landscaping in those private yards, which includes sunken patios. And then, you know, the length of this building is broken up by the sloped roof form and these recessed balconies, which I'll show you in some other views. So last thing I want to direct your attention to for this slide is the maximum building heights. On the left, you can see for an R1 zone structure, that height is 28 feet to the ridgeline. and for a R3 multifamily zone to the same measurement point, the ridge line, it's 35 feet. So a delta in allowed building height of 7 feet between the two zones. And then you might have picked up too that with the sort of natural slope of the site, the actual difference between the ridge lines due to the starting point of that measurement is really more in the neighborhood of 5 to 6 feet in height difference. So lastly, there are some building design and building design approval criteria. They're listed there for you to read, but the emphasis is really on variety of detail, form, and siting. The staff report clearly states the compliance with these criteria, so I won't go into great detail, but you can see from this collage of photos that we certainly do have pitched roofs, deep wall offsets, roof overhangs, in a variety of windows and a variety of material types. Since this is a site plan review process, I don't think we need to go into aesthetics other than to note that we have attempted to make the buildings compatible with single family homes through sympathetic roof forms and then sympathetic building materials. So here's an example of that. Boxes in dashed and magenta highlight the generous amount of wall plane offsets in the covered outdoor spaces that are part of these structures. So what you see highlighted are either private residential balconies, and there's an example of that in the rendering on the right, and then covered open walkways that provide access to the front doors of the residences. This rendering is if you are standing in that central pedestrian greenway, looking slightly uphill and to the south. And you'll notice that there is a very intentional closeness that provides a direct line of sight between all of the building entries. And this helps to encourage that interaction between residents that we're looking for, that greater sense of community. This particular rendering highlights one of the site's unique features, which is that seasonal seep that trickles down to Adams Creek. So that is here in this image, as we're now looking north, and then Adams Creek is the vegetation to the right of the image. The design response here was to create a small plaza where that seep, and specifically views to Adams Creek and views across the gorge, can be enjoyed by everyone. And we're in particular, we're looking at an elevation review here of building 3. And I think you can see how we've used the pitched roof forms, the variety of windows, and a variety of cladding materials to break down the scale of that building, and of course, the other structures on the site as well. Lastly, here's another view, this one a little bit higher, just to sort of show the alignment between the common house and the recreation building in the distance, that central greenway. Again, the common house is really the heart of the community and its place at the prominent location at the end of this greenway. So before we move on to any clarification questions, I'd like to close by acknowledging the following. The commission will definitely hear public testimony that expresses a great deal of frustration. And we acknowledge that frustration is understandable because change is difficult, and especially when that change comes suddenly. Many of the concerns that we're likely to hear are really outside the purview of this process. As Jennifer already alluded to, restrictions on parking being a good example. The staff report's pretty clear that the proposed development meets the criteria for site plan approval of permitted uses in the high density zone. And again, I would reiterate that we not only meet those criteria, in most cases we exceed them, and we are not asking for specific exemptions to those rules. Adams Creek Co-Housing provides desperately needed housing, and it provides it in a way that reflects smart multifamily density. It is a project that is good for the city of Hood River. We ask the commission's help in providing clarity to the concerned neighbors, and we ask for the commission's approval on behalf of those 25 households of Adams Creek Co-Housing who have been waiting eagerly and patiently for construction to begin and an opportunity to move into their new community. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Seth. So now what we'll do is we'll have commission questions for the applicant. Do any commissioners wish to question the applicant? Go ahead, Bill. And I can't see all of you, so you may have to just unmute yourself and speak if I don't recognize you, but Bill, I see.
Sure. I had a couple of questions. One, could you guys, it's interesting to me that we have, and I know there's probably some city engineering requirements, but it's interesting that we have Adams Creek Place coming through on Eugene, and it seems to go to nowhere or not much of anywhere on Hazel. What do you guys foresee the usage, vehicular usage and other usage of Adams Creek Place to be, would be one question. And then my other question.
Bill, why don't you just do one question at a time. I'm happy to call on you again.
Okay.
Adams Creek Place is a necessity primarily based on firefighting access. And so we would love to play that down to nothing more than a fire lane or a phrase called VUNERF, which is really a pedestrian oriented style of a street. But once we've triggered certain criteria, we are into the realm of city standards for any local street. There are some very specific reasons that maybe Stoner Bell could speak to about the extent of the roadway and how it does or does not align with the actual roadway, the gravel portion of Hazel Avenue. We've heard a lot of concerns from adjacent neighbors, particularly the resident at 1421 Sherman, about the sort of unintended consequences of these criteria. We would love to submit a what's known as a design exception or a variance to work with the neighbors to sort of fine-tune some of those engineering standards and shrink it up so that's really appropriate to the minimal use of very minimal vehicular use that it will actually see.
Okay, Bill, keep going.
Next question. You had a slide that showed, had a question on pedestrian access to Andy's Way, I think. And I guess for ex parte contact, I've looked on the county GIS map, and it seems like where that Andy's Way alignment would be happening is straight into the parking area, not maybe into a place that it could be, it could happen. Did you have any comment on where you drew that pink line? That ends into a household, private property.
Yeah, so the pink line was really just to bring up the talking point, which was that we understood that the requirement for, or the, it was more of a soft request for that connection. And because we considered it the pre-application meeting minutes to say that it was suggested, but then we heard from so many of the adjacent property owners their concern about having that connection, we submitted the application without that linkage. So how exactly that would work, it would probably end up being it would have to be a fairly intensive construction of retaining walls, steps, and a additional connection to make that grade change in the right location.
Okay.
Any more questions, Bill?
Yeah, I have one. What's the plan? I see what looks like, and I'm trying to read the legend. It seems like there's a little gravel driveway extension to the north off of Adams Creek Place up towards the common house. Do you have any, can you put any commentary on that use?
Yeah, so that graphic is really just an acknowledgement that to someday in the future service the 20-foot water easement, which you can see there's a faint purple line here. So that's a no build zone, and the water department would need vehicular access, require it in fact, to someday service that public water line that exists in the ground. So, you know, I think this, we can acknowledge that this material could be a number of things. It's proposed as gravel in this diagram, but it's essentially maintenance access for the city.
That's it.
Bill, are you done?
Yes.
Okay, anyone else? Any other commissioners have questions? Tina?
Yeah, I just have one about the connectivity of the site vis-a-vis the rest of the community. If there were, say, kids who lived on Sherman Avenue who were headed to the middle school, is this considered public access, your walkways through the property? And how would property owners feel about, you know, neighborhood kids walking through there, or people on bikes walking through there? Is there going to be any sort of regulations regarding that?
Is this a question for the applicant or for staff?
Well, I guess I would start with the applicant. I mean, are there going to be any regulations in the community marking these as private roads or, you know, residents only, that type of thing?
Yeah, I think it would be akin to Andy's Way itself, which I understand is it's actually private property. The pedestrian network through the site is private property, but there's no fencing or gating to discourage any of the neighbors from taking advantage of those connections.
Seth, can I add as well, like, so this is Jim. Our intent is not to have a gated community. Our intent is to have a place where we welcome our neighbors. So I think from that respect, you know, as long as a pedestrian would come through and do it in a way that's consistent with the values of the community, we would of course welcome them.
I mean, the reason I ask is because, you know, we struggle with connectivity with a lot of these planned unit developments. And I mean, because this is a large parcel, I could very clearly see people who are headed to the pool or headed to the school. I mean, it's going to become kind of a natural place for people on foot to want to transit through. And I guess I would want that clarification if this is going to have, you know, private road, private property signs or not. And you're saying, it sounds like you're saying no.
Yeah, so I think what we had planned to do is have some sort of a posting saying that this is private property, but visitors are welcome, you know, please treat it, you know, respectfully, essentially. You know, as it is now, we're allowing our neighbors to go through our property and have welcomed them. So that would still be our intent. Like I said, we don't want to build a gated community here.
Okay. And then just one other question. Yeah, regarding stormwater, it sounds like there are still some things to be debated, but are any of these pathways or parking areas specified to be pervious or permeable paving, or are they asphalt or gravel, or what are they specified as?
The specific details should be in the legend from the application, which I don't believe is on this particular. Yes.
Oh, I have the page. Yeah. Okay. But, so asphalt. So that's just traditional blacktop asphalt.
Mixture of asphalt and then concrete walkways everywhere. A few locations where gravel or a compressed rock would be appropriate, but with approval from the city engineer, of course. And that might be the tandem parking spaces. It'd be great if that could be a little bit less obtrusive material compared to, say, asphalt.
Okay, but you, yeah, okay. Okay, thank you.
Anything else, Tina?
Nope, that's it for now. Thank you.
Any other questions from commissioners?
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
The stormwater drainage pond over there by the parking area, you mentioned that was designed to accommodate a 25-year event, storm event. Is that the minimum requirement? I mean, how does that work? What is a 25-year? I'm accustomed to like a 100-year floodplain kind of concept as opposed to this 25-year event.
Not being a civil engineer, I might call on Senator Bell to help answer that question.
That's based off the city engineering standards, which is also based off of code for the stormwater. And a 25-year event is really common for development all across the state of Oregon. There's actually several events that they have to make sure that they match. There's a 2-year event and a 10-year event and a 25-year event. Statistically, events beyond that, we only make sure that overflows wouldn't cause property damage. But the statistical reoccurrence in a risk analysis type scenario, just, you know, across the nation, this is a very common standard. It says 25 years is the kind of the level where risk tolerance versus the cost of detention or containment makes sense.
Okay. Anything else, Sue?
Yeah, I have another question for Seth. I may have misinterpreted, but I thought you implied that the Andes Way connection already exists, or it does not exist at all. We talked about, like, it's currently used by middle school kids right now. Did I misunderstand that?
Well, to the extent that there is a dirt path through the Blackberry Brambles is the current.
Okay. And then one final question, kind of along with this picture that you have up right now. You talked about, I think you said a soft wall between the carport and the garage on the other existing home there. Did I hear that right? And what is a soft wall? Does that mean like a hedge?
I don't think I used that term specifically, but that's a very good example. A side obscuring hedge might be a landscaping strategy for what we see here just beyond the driveway.
Okay, all right. But not a concrete constructed wall.
No, we are not proposing at this time any traditional.
Right, that's what I read, okay.
Only retaining walls and landscaping.
Okay, thank you, I'm done.
Thank you, Sue. Any other commissioners have questions?
This is Bill.
Bill, go ahead.
I have one question where I was kind of wondering about a discrepancy, and this is building design. I'm looking at PRA 1.2, which is your kind of site, overall site plan. And I have a question specifically about the parking, covered parking structure. And then if you look at part of the submittal, the 1.7, it's got a east elevation for that building, and it shows that some of them are probably enclosed. Is that the case? And I think there's a west elevation as well. So I guess the question is, could you describe that building in a little bit more detail?
Certainly, I'd be happy to do that. So when we call that building covered parking or a carport, it is intended at the moment in its maximum build-out footprint to be a combination of both carport spaces, so just shade cover only, and then private, say, two-car garages for those residents who wish to have that specific amenity.
And then, obviously, one of our, I think the design criteria talks about uninterrupted facades, and that seems to be the west elevation there seems to be greater than 100 feet. Could you kind of comment on any design characteristics of that?
So the way that it was presented for review by staff is that the difference between the carport zone and the private car zone, which has the doors on it, in combination with a step in the height of that, a step in the roof plane of that long structure, would break it into two segments, both less than 100 feet in length. So I think that would probably be a point of clarification between the applicant and the reviewing staff member to determine if that in itself was sufficient or if some additional measures would be required to demonstrate wall plane offsets and other techniques for breaking up the length of that building.
That's it for me.
Okay, anyone else? Mark, Erica, Megan. Okay, it looks like we are done with the questions for the applicant. And so next we're going to go on to take public testimony. Jennifer made me promise that I would ask you guys if you need a recess. So do we need a brief recess for a bathroom break, et cetera, now, or should we go right into public testimony? Jennifer is nodding yes. So Jennifer is asking for a recess. Mark is asking for 5 minutes. So we will do a 5 minute recess. It's 7:51. We will be back at 7:56. So we are now in recess. Thank you. We got Bill. We have Dustin.
I'm here. I just took off my video.
Tina and Sue.
Hey, I'm Megan's here.
And I'm going to guess Erica's there too.
Just a heads up, I muted everyone while you were gone.
I'm here. Erica. Erica's here.
Oh, great. Thank you. And Jennifer, are you there yet? Okay, so staff ready. Jonathan, are we ready to continue? Are we recording? We didn't actually disappear. We continued with everything.
Right, we were good to continue.
Okay, great. So now we are prepared to take public testimony. So let me go back to my script. I'm sorry, I have to pull this up. So we did applicant's testimony, now we are going to do proponents. So as you recall, we asked in advance for folks who wish to testify to notify us, and we have a list which has been sent to me, and I currently have 16 people on the list as proponents who wish to address us. I have 5 people on the list as opponents who wish to address us, and no one on the list as neutral. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest a 3-minute time limit, and I'm going to request that you acknowledge that being repetitive doesn't really help us, and focusing as well as you can on the approval criteria is what we really need to hear about. And we have read all of your material. We've read all the submittals already. So if you have already submitted something, there's really no reason to read it to us, because we've sat down and read it beforehand. So I just want to check with the Planning Commission. Are you all satisfied with those rules, basically with a 3-minute limit and a request for people not to be repetitive and to stick to approval criteria? So given those thumbs up, we're going to continue. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to juggle too many screens at once. So as I said, a 3-minute limit, and you're welcome to use less than 3 minutes. You're also welcome to say that I agree with what's already been said. So I just want to give a thumbs up to that. So we really appreciate anything you can do to save us some time. So let's start. Number one is Nancy Roach. Jonathan, can you promote Nancy? And I'll give you on deck. So each person I'm going to tell you, and I'll tell you who's on deck. So Allison McDonald is on deck. It says AKA Allison Bryan. So Nancy, promote and be ready to promote Allison.
Mr. Chair, could you have everyone state their name and their address just so we can keep the record clean as well, please?
Thank you. I will do that. So Nancy, we would like you to state your name and address for the record.
Okay. Hi, everybody, and thanks for the opportunity to speak tonight. My name is Nancy Roach. I'm here with my husband, Greg Crafts.
Our address is 2 Eugene Street in Hood River. Many of you know Greg because he's been involved with innovating housing in Hood River for a long time. And we both reviewed the very extensive packet and created these comments. And it's been interesting tonight hearing people talk about Katie's Way and Andy's Lane. We did that project. We've done that. We did McKinley Court, Cottage Lane, and the townhouses at 12th and Montello, plus a bunch of other places around town. Those specific proposals increased the housing density, which was very controversial, and not all of them have garages and sidewalks in order to keep the costs down. And again, that was very controversial. I think at this point, most of the people in the community see these small, relatively less expensive developments as a community benefit. I mean, we actually know people who were only able to buy a home in Hood River because we deliberately built them to be affordable. For what it's worth, and I think this is germane tonight, because we were proposing something different, we were at times accused of trying to do something illegal and destructive to the community, and that was really hard. The Adams Creek project is a different type of community, but there are common goals between what we did and what they're proposing. Our goal was to mostly get first-time home buyers into houses. Their goal is to create a small community that will add to Hood River, and they're prepared to spend their own money on improvements to the pedestrian network and the frontage. And those benefits ultimately help everyone in the community. Likewise, we never set out to maximize profit from our houses. And the Adams Creek project is not trying to maximize profit. They're proposing 26 units and they're building a home, not a for-profit development. We followed this project over the last few years and know some of the people involved. In fact, our son, Andy, of Andy's Way, is married to Pat and Becky Rawson's daughter. Groups that enter into this type of arrangement work hard to get along with and add to the community. We visited the Adams Creek site and completely understand why the neighborhood is opposed to the development. Change is hard. The little neighborhood that Greg and I live in is very different from the neighborhood we bought into in 1992. Living through construction is a royal pain, and change is a fact of life. We strongly believe that the Adams Creek co-housing project will ultimately add to Hood River, both with the infrastructure improvements and with a sense of community that I think will help build us. And I think it will provide an innovative benefit to the community, an innovative housing type that's a benefit to the community. Thank you. And I think that's under 3 minutes.
Arthur, you're on mute, Arthur.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for watching me. I was thanking you for being sensitive. You actually were just under 3 minutes, and I appreciate your monitoring that. And Allison is next. Can you promote Allison? And Allison, we need your name and address for the record, and you have 3 minutes, please. And you're still muted there. Jonathan, can you help unmute Allison?
I can only ask her to unmute. I can't unmute her computer.
Oh, okay. Allison, we know you have the ability to talk to us because we heard you before. So can you unmute, please? Okay, I'm not seeing Allison, so we can come back to her later. Let's go on to Heather. And so Heather Staden is next, and the Shira Reich is after that. So we'll go to Heather, and just remind me to go back to Allison before we leave proponents. So it says Thrive Hood River. I assume that's Heather.
That's me. Can you hear Heather, me?
Yes, we do. Name and address for the record, please.
Great. My name is Heather Staten, and I'm the executive director of Thrive Hood River. Our address is P.O. Box 1544, Hood River. As you know, the city of Hood River has done extensive work on housing in the last 5 years, including a housing needs analysis, which showed a need for more diverse housing types, especially multifamily housing. As your city attorney told you today, this project is needed housing. Your concerns tonight are about the code and the approval criteria. But listening to Jim Miller, one of the proponents of the project, I was reminded that housing is really about people and about community. And I can't think of any housing project application that's come before you that so intentionally seeks to create a inclusive, supportive community. The applicants have also made a strong effort to respect the very special natural features of the site in a way that they've proposed to handle wetlands, Adams Creek, and mature trees on the site. Their tree retention plans are especially refreshing compared to what we've seen in other projects in town, where the property owner removes every tree from the site prior to seeking a land use permit. I also wanted to note the very high level of right-of-way improvements that staff is recommending as part of this development, along with water, sewer, stormwater, and transportation SDCs, and paying a proportionate share of various intersections. The applicants are required to build a ton of transportation infrastructure, bike lanes and sidewalks on Sherman, paving Hazel, a sidewalk including ADA compliant ramps and driveways all along the north side of Eugene. This is, I imagine, a significant lift for the applicant. I would imagine that it's probably in excess of $100,000 in right-of-way improvements for the city. Some of these projects are on the city's TSP project list. And I could see developers pushing back against this level of extraction, but this developer hasn't pushed back. They've instead agreed to make these improvements and to show that they really want to be an asset to the neighborhood and the city and the community. And I encourage you to approve the project. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heather. Next up is Nishira Reich, and on deck is John Boonstra.
Hi, my name is Nishira Reich, and I live at 724 Prospect Avenue in Hood River. I'm shortening my testimony, but I would like to send it in for the record in the next 7 days. So in the 2 years—
I'm sorry, Nishira, let me just clarify. So are you requesting that we leave the record open?
Yes, please.
Okay, we will take that as a formal request. That's an important distinction. So staff, please note that we've had a request to keep the record open.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You could let me restart the timer on you, but go ahead.
Okay. Yes. I'm at 724 Prospect Avenue in Hood River. In the 2 years since we purchased the property and assembled our professional team, we have managed to create an amazing community, one that's devoted to living conscientiously on the land, sharing resources, and having a really good time together. Many of us are active members in our greater community and involved in all sorts of organizations and nonprofits around the Gorge. Some of these are Columbia Gorge Climate Action Network, Hood River County Energy Task Force, the Rockford Grange, Hood River County School District, Aging in the Gorge Alliance, the Warming Shelter, Columbia Gorge Women's Action Network, Voce Choir, Latinx Outreach, Gorge Ecumenical Ministries, churches, book groups, local AmeriCorps, Fish Food Bank, the Senior Center, Hood River Trails, Hood River Emergency Operations, and teaching ESL. After we move in, I'm looking forward to all sorts of things we'll be able to collaborate on in the greater Hood River community. We want to be compassionate and inclusive of our immediate neighborhood and the greater Hood River community around us. We've reached out to future neighbors and we understand they are nervous about our project. I sympathize with their worries. Many of the visual and building placement changes they wanted us to do to our plans, we wanted to change too. And when we looked into it again, we were told again that we're not allowed to do those design changes due to many different requirements we have in order to meet code. And we could not find any good exceptions or workarounds for this. So while we weren't able to please our new neighbors like we wanted to, we are all still committed to being good neighbors to them and hope that when we finally move in, we'll be able to create an extended community with them too. Thanks for listening. And I'm being told that I shouldn't, that my nobody wants me to recommend an extended for 7 days. So I retract that if that's okay.
That is okay. You're certainly welcome to do that. just so folks understand what's going on. Anyone has the right to request that we, because this is the first evidentiary hearing under Oregon state law, anyone has the right to request a 7-day extension to submit written comments. If someone does so, then we will not be able to deliberate this evening. I'm not sure if we'll be able to deliberate this evening anyway, but if there's a request, then we will be rescheduling deliberation for September 26th, I think it is. In any case, we get that you are not making that request, so we will keep on going. Thank you for the clarification. You just saw my reaction. And so John Boonstra, you're next. And I'm sorry, and Marilyn Kakuto is on deck.
All right, thank you. Can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
Okay, good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the commission. I am John Boonstra. I live at 1002 Cascade. I've been a Hood River resident for 14 years. I do work as one of the leaders of the Columbia Gorge Climate Action Network, and I'm a member of the Adams Creek Cohousing community. I just want to make a few points about why Adams Creek Cohousing, and maybe I'll just call it ACC to keep to my 3 minutes, is important for our future. ACC has worked hard to become one of the few multi-housing developments whose site plan includes energy efficiency and cost savings by becoming net zero ready. ACC will not utilize any fossil fuels like piped natural gas. It seeks to reduce its carbon emissions and establish goals for a sustainable environmental footprint in keeping with the City of Hood River's climate emergency resolution passed in 2019. The ACC site layout seeks to utilize solar panels for its energy and additionally for the grid. ACC consults with and reports its sustainability progress and relevant design criteria to the Energy Trust of Oregon, the Hood River Energy Advisory Committee, the New Buildings Institute, and other co-housing developments throughout the nation. ACC is modeling what it means to preserve Adams Creek and its wetlands and its natural resources, and is planning for restoring native species throughout the project's 55% green space. I'll conclude with a few words from the Columbia Gorge Climate Action Network. Enabling the development of Adams Creek co-housing sends a positive message and models our commitment to smart growth, economic vitality, and sustainable development and energy practices to build a future for all of us. So, members of the commission, I urge you to make a decision to build a stronger, healthier, and more resilient future for Hood River. And I urge you to support the Adams Creek housing proposal before you tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Next is Marilyn, and on deck is Becky Rawson. And what I will also add is, I know it's hard for you to keep track of the time. You're all doing great, but I will do this. I don't know if you can see that. I will do a T when you're 15 seconds, just as an indicator that you're coming close to the end of your time. I don't want to distract you, but just let you manage your time a little bit better. So Marilyn, please introduce yourself and speak to us.
Hello. My name is Marilyn Kakuto, and I am speaking on my behalf, and also Margaret Tumas. We both live in White Salmon at 820 Southwest Stratton Road. We wish to provide input on the site plans by the Adams Creek Co-Housing Project and are extremely supportive of the opportunity to have this new and diverse community development within the city of Hood River. It will consist of both individuals at various stages of their lives and families with children from toddlers to young adults. As a global initiative, co-housing is well known and has a positive influence internationally. We believe the Adams Creek co-housing community in Hood River will be a flagship example of a growing movement here in the United States. Even before development begins, several of the Adams Creek co-housing members are working to restore the wetland and improve the habitat of the existing Sherman Avenue House property. They have been removing the invasive non-native plant species and are restoring safer access paths down to the creek and have already improved the flow and beauty of the sights and sounds of Adams Creek. Lastly, and importantly, the members plan to reduce their community's impact on energy resources and environmental and climate degradation that accompanies most new housing development of any type, whether single or multifamily. The goal here is to be net zero ready with solar energy infrastructure and no reliance on natural gas for heating, cooling, or cooking. State-of-the-art energy conserving materials and methods will be used in construction with care to shield the neighborhood from the intrusive appearance of a, quote, condo building, unquote, using landscape vegetative screening and lower building profiles. The members have a strong desire to be inclusive of the surrounding neighbors and children and to participate in neighborhood life outside of the co-housing community itself. Adams Creek co-housing members have already begun work on a community car sharing plan featuring electric cars, charging stations, and a variety of multi-purpose vehicles to efficiently serve the travel and cargo needs of its members. This should reduce the overall traffic in and out of the community and hopefully negate guest parking impacts on the immediately surrounding neighborhood. We, Margaret Tumas and Marilyn Kokuto, heartily support the Adams Creek co-housing development as a welcome addition to the vibrant life and well-being of the city of Hood River. Thank you for letting us speak.
Thank you, Marilyn, and you had 15 seconds. You guys are timing pretty well, I'm impressed. Becky Rawson is next, and then Paul Hoffman is on deck.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Rawson, and I live at 1368 Rawson Road. My family and I have lived in Hood River for 31 years. I'm a nurse practitioner at Providence Hospital, where I have worked since I moved here 31 years ago, along with my dog. In my work in the world of healthcare, most decisions that I make are colored by the lens of provision of the value of health, whether it is physical, mental, emotional, or environmental. As city planners, in many ways, you too are making decisions that reflect the value of the health of our city's population, and you're making those on a daily basis. Your recently updated 2020 goals all reflect values that in different ways point to assuring health and vitality for our residents. The city's 2020 goals, such as working towards diverse housing inventory, community engagement, encouraging walking and biking, sustainable environmental decisions, safe infrastructure, and community needs for open space will facilitate choices that help ensure a vibrant, thriving, healthy population. Your 2020 City of Hood River goals are also 100% aligned with the values and realization of the Adams Creek project you are being asked to review. Each of your thoughtfully considered goals is repeatedly reflected in the plans of Adams Creek co-housing. We seek to add to the diversity of the city's housing inventory, complying with Goal 10 and state law. We seek to engage all segments of our community through civic involvement to avoid parking congestion, utilize biking and pedestrian means of transport, create an environmentally sustainable community, and assist in preparing for growth infrastructure, finally, also to maintain open space. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of any recently approved property developments in our city that dovetail more perfectly with the City of Hood River's 2020 goals. Expanding beyond the city limits, it's important to consider the larger picture that reduces the pressure on urban sprawl by removing a potential of 25 single family units from that market and instead using infill development with the advantages that lead to reduction of car traffic and carbon emissions. The pressure on our high value farmland and the Columbia Gorge scenic area from development is ever increasing, and we need a consolidated effort to resist such trends. Adams Creek fits very well into this concept and should be embraced by our environmental organizations as well, such as Friends of the Columbia Gorge and Columbia River Keepers, as well as our City of Hood River. Now, more than ever before in our history, initiatives that prepare our wider community for a healthy, resilient future are of paramount importance. And the chance to be forward thinkers on a project such as this is unique. Thank you for your thoughtful consideration and your service to our community.
Thank you, your timing was good. Next, Paul Hoffman, and on deck is Becky Montgomery speaking for Heidi Venture. And Paul, we're not here. You're not muted, but we're not hearing you.
Is this better?
Oh, yep, we hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, I'm Paul Hoffman. I live at 1528 Cascade Avenue here in Hood River. And thank you for letting me speak for a moment tonight. I'll be brief. So my wife and I, Tara, we moved with our daughter, Miel, to Hood River 4 years ago in preparation of our second child, Ash. We wanted to be closer to family, and we had dreamed for a long time of living in beautiful Hood River, ever since vacationing here like 15 years ago. So about 2 years after moving here, we had bought a home and we were settled in, but we heard of this Adams Creek co-housing project and the desire of the group to integrate density within the walkable core of our vibrant town while maintaining a commitment to sustainable environmental guidelines. And so we were instantly interested. The group was also committed to preserving this Adams Creek that we've heard so much about tonight. And to accomplish this, they further increased their density in a small section while leaving roughly half of the property as green space. So we were excited to see such a forward-thinking, community-centered development happening here in our town. So Tyra and I were so impressed with the nature of the group that we decided to attend one of their open houses. And after attending that open house, we made the decision as a family that Adams Creek co-housing was actually perfect for us as well. We started out being more just as interested as a member of Hood River community. My daughter will be going into the fourth grade this year at May Street Elementary. But she's already looking forward to the sixth grade when she'll be able to walk right around the corner to Hood River Middle School. We look forward to adding to the vibrancy of the neighborhood and being a positive part of the greater Hood River community. So thank you again for the opportunity to speak tonight.
Thank you very much, Paul. Next is Becky Montgomery speaking for ID Venture, and on deck is Jack Lerner. And you can get started, Becky. I just need to turn my light on or my face is going to disappear. So I'm on, I hear your audio. I'm just going to disappear for a sec.
Arthur, we do not have Becky Montgomery.
Okay.
Attendees. I've checked and checked for aliases or phone numbers and none of them match up.
Okay, so Becky, if you are there, please raise your hand. Otherwise, we're going to go on to Jack Lerner. Oh, I see Adams Creek Co-Housing has a raised hand. So that must be Becky.
That is me, sorry.
Great.
My name is Becky Montgomery, and I live at 1956 Belmont Drive in Hood River. I've been a member of Adams Creek Co-Housing for 4 years and have been working really hard and to make this a wonderful community. I've been asked to read a statement from a supportive neighbor who is not available tonight. Dear Planning Commissioners, I'm a neighbor of the proposed Adams Creek co-housing project you are considering tonight. I live at 713 Cady's Lane, just a few houses south of their proposed parking area. I wholeheartedly support this proposed development and hope that you will approve their plans at this meeting. I look forward to seeing the land taken care of instead of continuing to decline into disrepair. In its current state, the property is home to invasive plants and animal pests and is of little use for humans. My request to you as a public servant is that you would follow the regulations that apply to this application, follow the applicable codes and precedences, act in fairness towards the group of people who purchased this land and planned a wonderful community for it. The land to be developed is a private property zone, properly zoned for the intended use. It isn't public property for the enjoyment, use, and control of its neighbors. I look forward to having a thriving co-housing community in my neighborhood. One day soon, I believe the Adams Creek co-housing development will become a center of community for the whole neighborhood, including those who now oppose it. Thank you for your service to the city of Hood River, Heidi Venture.
Thank you, Becky, on behalf of Heidi. Next is Jack Lerner, and then Milt Markowitz is on deck.
Yes, hi, this is Jack Lerner. I live at 6465 Trout Creek Ridge Road in Parkdale. My wife Janet and I were one of the original nine members of Gorge Co-Housing, And we sunk a significant portion, as all of us did, and all of our additional members have done, into making this community a reality. And as you've heard over and over again, this community has strived to not only meet, but to exceed many of the values that are embodied in the state and city code. And the reason for that is because we share those values. Those are our values. Many of these things, we don't have them simply in order to get approval. We have them because that's what we want to see done. That's why we have 55% of our property dedicated to green space instead of 20%. That's why we're doing a trip sharing and car sharing program in order to reduce the traffic impact on our surrounding community and our own energy efficiency. That's why we have less density than the zoning, sorry, not less density, but lower number of units by more than half than the zoning would allow. And the reason why is because we are forming a community for ourselves to live in, to be a part of the neighborhood of which we're a part, and not merely to come in and maximize profits and leave. So I think that even our neighbors who object to the project will find that while we may make mistakes along the way, we are going to strive to be deserving of their support, and that that they would appreciate our being there once this period of transition is over and done with. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Jack. So next is Milt Markowitz, and on deck is Patrick Rawson.
Hi, my name is Milt Markowitz. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
And I live at 1950 Sterling Place. That's down Manor. I'm in apartment 212. And I'm relatively new to Hood River, just lived here a little over 2 years, and a new member, actually, of the Adams Creek Co-Housing Group. But they asked me a few weeks ago if I would head up a new normal team, kind of recognizing that we don't want to go back to whatever was normal 2 months ago, that we really need to change our culture and so on. And I can tell you that that work was very rewarding. I was absolutely amazed at how the vision and guiding principles that people had laid out for the community gave us a bridge to get to that new normal. So I personally think that we're going to be facing some real difficult situations over the next few years, and a new normal with a significantly enhanced ethic, cultural ethic, is going to be on the horizon. So I can just say now that I am so glad to be part of the ACC group working with these kinds of people, and very, very pleased to be in Hood River, where there are so many community members who are also forward thinking. So thank you very much for this process, and thank you all the people that have spoken.
Thank you, Milt. Next is Patrick Rawson, and Donna McCoy is on deck.
Okay, and I have nothing to add. It has not already been said. I just want to thank you for your service and for your professionalism. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Donna McCoy, and on deck is Kathleen Patton.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, thank you.
Okay, my name is Donna McCoy. I live at 1506 Belmont Drive. And I've been a resident of Hood River for 15 years, but I've been coming here for 25, 30 years. My kids live here. My grandkids have all been educated through the schools here. So I'm very connected to the community. One of the things I love is that Adams Creek Co-Housing provides an option for a lot of people. As we go through life, we go through different stages and we have different needs. And the co-housing is a wonderful option for people with families, for people without families. I'm looking forward to continuing to be a grandparent and an aunt. It's wonderful that we can share our lives and care about each other. And I thank you very much for this hearing and for all the comments that people have made and for your consideration. And I agree with all the other testimony we've heard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna. And next is Kathleen Patton, and then Peter Zurcher is on deck.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Patton, and I live at 1645 24th Avenue, Longview, Washington. And I mainly want to thank you for hearing us tonight and agree with all the previous speakers. All I would add is just how wonderful and impressive and joyous it is to see that little creek emerge from under the piles and piles and piles of blackberry and ivy. And that's happening because people care, not because a developer is coming in and making it happen. It's happening because people want to restore that beautiful part of our community. And it's something that I think the whole community will benefit from, as well as the creatures and the native plants. Thank you for hearing us tonight.
Thank you, Kathleen. Peter is next, and Tara Holden is on deck.
Hi, everybody. I assume you can hear me.
You can, Peter. Thank you.
I'm Peter Zurcher. I live at 1956 Belmont Avenue, married to Becky, who spoke earlier and read the letter for Heidi Venture. We have been involved in this development since basically 4 years, and were part of the original members that bought this property. We look very much forward to living there soon. Everything really that's on my heart has been said. I could not put it better. I certainly agree with the housing needs that exist in Hood River, that I've seen firsthand through friends that have problems finding housing here. So this is certainly very important to me. And I really don't have anything else to add, and just thank you for this hearing and for listening to us, and I hope very much that you will make the right decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Next is Tara Holden, and then I'm going to put Allison McDonald. So we're done with the list of proponents that we have so far. So Allison McDonald is going to be on deck again in case she's shown up, and then we'll ask if there's anyone else before we go on to opponents. So Tara Holden, please.
Hi, this is Tara. I think that was a mistake. I wasn't going to speak. I just wanted to.
Oh, okay. You're not required to speak. We're happy to take you off. Thank you very much, Tara.
Thank you.
Let's try Allison McDonald. Is Allison here now? Jonathan, can you try that?
Ms. McDonald, if you are here, please use the raise hand button.
Allison, please raise your hand, or else we'll move on. Okay, and while we're doing that, so we're going to finish up with the proponents. So I need to ask, does anyone who has not yet spoken wish to speak in favor of the application? So are there any additional proponents who would like an opportunity to address us?
Mr. Chair, I would also add that for folks who are wanting to testify that didn't notify me ahead of time in particular, please make sure that the name that you have on your Zoom is your first and last name. It makes it easier for us to identify you to allow you to speak.
Okay, thank you very much, Jennifer, for that. So I'm not seeing anyone else. I'm not seeing any hands raised. Jonathan, are there any hands raised?
No, there are not.
Okay, so now we have no one registered for neutral, but I'm going to ask, does anyone wish to speak neither for nor against? In other words, do you have a question to raise concerning procedure, or do you wish to speak in a neutral manner? So is there anyone who wishes to raise their hand to do that? And Jonathan?
It does not look like it.
Okay, great. So now we're going to go to opponents. And so we have five people registered to speak as opponents. And of course, we have plenty of written material in opposition also. We have one small problem. Dan Bell, I see that you have registered to speak for yourself. And then we also have you delivering a statement for Kelly Morris. In the past, we haven't allowed that. because that basically lets you get two dips at the well, so to speak. So I'm wondering if you can find someone else to read the statement or submit that in writing or something like that. So Dan, I see you raised your hand anyway, so we're gonna recognize you to speak. And before I start the clock, you can explain what you'd like to do about that second position on the list.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairman. I just want to ask a question. Didn't that just happen with Heidi Venture in the
No, it didn't, because Becky Montgomery didn't speak otherwise, in my understanding. I don't see her name elsewhere on this list.
Okay, thank you.
So she got three minutes because, you know, she got 3 minutes for herself, and she used that to read someone else's statement.
With 30 seconds notice, I can't provide an alternative for Kelly's comments. They're in the written testimony. They are item K23 on page 135 of attachment 3.
Thank you very much, Dan. And you, as soon as you give your name and address, I'll start the timing then. So go ahead.
Is this my own testimony?
Yes, you may start whenever you'd like. And you know, we need your name and address, and I won't start the timer until you give us that.
Thank you very much, Chairman Babbitts. My name is Dan Bell. I live at 1509 Eugene Street. I've been sitting through the last three or so hours of this meeting looking out a window at Eugene Street and have seen about three cars go by in the course of the time. Usually on a night like tonight, you would see the neighbors across the street setting up little wooden ramps for their little girls to practice mountain biking. And I want to thank those of you who came down to Eugene Street for the first time today. I drive down it every day. This is our neighborhood, and I hope that matters. Chairman Babbitts, I appreciate your earlier comments, and you really clarified what I really wanted to say. I'm going to reserve some time because both Commissioner Powers asked some questions about wetlands, and I'd love to talk a little history with you. But I want to first say, just direct you to written testimony in K26 on page 140, I believe that's right, of attachment 3. And I think the question here is pretty clear. The Planning Commission issued an incomplete letter to the applicant in late May, without any public notification, without any communication with the neighbors who had asked to be notified about this. And after the applicant had submitted a minimal amount of information and said they wanted to go ahead, the planning department deemed the application complete. That was incorrect. And what they've delivered to you tonight, and we've heard throughout the testimony, is an incomplete application. They cannot describe what their wetlands impacts are. They cannot clarify their stormwater concept. They cannot and have not addressed some of the conditions in the city's recommendation, such as the, how do you fit Andy's Way, that path with that, with a parking lot in the wetlands. They clearly show a stormwater drainage pipe going into a wetland and impacting water quality in Adams Creek. So what I'd like to say to you is that the planning department didn't have a requirement. While the applicant had a right to say, hey, we're done, the planning department didn't have a requirement to call this complete. They did call this complete. They sent it to you with wholly inadequate information to really make an informed decision on the use of this piece of property. 72 conditions indicates a plan that is not really well conceived. That is unusual, and that is really not what we want to trust. And I want to say that as the neighbors who have tried and tried and tried to engage in this process, an approval with all of these conditions cuts us out of the public process in all of these details that need to be worked out later. So with that, I'm just going to say real quickly, Chairman Babbitts, looking at the title of this property, you'd be interested to know that there was a 1937 easement run a laundromat, like the water from the property, and run a laundromat over on 13th and State. So it has a lot of history. I appreciate your comments earlier about that.
Thank you very much, Dan, and I will tell you about that laundromat sometime if you want to talk about that.
Oh, that would be great. I'd love to hear about that. That was really interesting to hear.
Great. So I'm sorry, I forgot to, I'm sorry, I'm just juggling a few things. Could you repeat for us the reference that you gave us to the K section of comments?
K26 is the attachment.
Yep.
It's on page 140 of attachment 3. You'll note that we had 24 neighbors sign on to a letter that made a couple of arguments, a lot of technical arguments. But based on the earlier conversations, I think really what we're talking about is whether this application is complete and ready for a decision by the Planning Commission tonight in its current form. We've just heard about a lot of things that are not fully developed. We've heard from the City Engineering Department that they're not fully developed. And so
thank
we
very much, Dan.
In K26.
Thank you for that clarification. So next, I should have explained, Heather Hendrickson is next on the list of opponents and Mark Zandmiller is on deck. So Heather, hopefully we can promote you to speaker.
Yep, can you hear me?
I hear you, I don't see, you appear under Dan Bell, so I'm gonna assume that you're in the same
place. That's my wife.
Okay, thank you.
I also live at 1509 Eugene Street. And I'm here today to urge you to deny the proposal for the site plan review at Adams Creek Co-Housing. I mean, I really question whether with 72 conditions, this proposal is even ready to be reviewed. I have some serious concerns about the streams and wetlands. The development threatens to destroy them and the plants and animals that rely on them by placing the buildings and the parking lot in the riparian area and immediately adjacent to the springs and creek. I also have concerns about removing at least a third of the trees on the property and what that will do to the creek in terms of reducing the shade and increasing stream temperatures, which is important because this creek flows into the Columbia River. You'll notice on the design sheet, there's a stormwater drainage pipe that goes directly into the jurisdictional wetland and into Adams Creek. And this really conflicts with their continual statements that there's no impacts to the jurisdictional wetlands or water quality. And also on map C9 of their design plans, you can see a sewer line that goes and traverses directly under one of the jurisdictional wetlands. And that should not be allowed. They're gonna have to reroute that to not have an impact on that wetland. Megan, to your comment about the neighborway, it's not included on the newest design maps. And you know, we wonder whether there would actually even be room for that. And also to your question there, or I think it was Sue's question, there is a wall proposed along the west side of the carport that Seth did not address, but it was in his slide that he showed that there is a wall there along the edge of the carport there. I would strongly suggest that this property have a geotechnical analysis before determining whether building on the site is appropriate. There's tons of seeps and streams and all this groundwater flowing through this area into the creek. And I just think it's gonna be problematic for the building in the long run anyway. And then on the wetland, sorry, I've been jotting a bunch of notes since we've been talking tonight. The wetland did meet 3 of the 4 criteria to make it a significant wetland. The only reason it wasn't deemed significant is because it's not a fish bearing stream. And then, let's see, just to address a couple of the other things that I just heard in the pro comments tonight, they talk about solar panels and being totally dependent on solar energy, but those were not included on the building design heights. So would that increase the height of those buildings at all? I'm not sure. And then there's, for the little jog around the Sherman Creek Bridge over the creek on Sherman Creek, there would need to be an easement and ADA accessibility on any kind of sidewalk or bump out along Sherman Avenue there. And just to close, I'm really passionate about wetlands and streams. I would say that building a building or any kind of buildings as close to the wetlands as they're proposing, you can't do that without having an impact on those wetlands. So anyway, I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I apologize that I'm not better at shutting off this alarm. sorry about that. thank you very much, Heather. Next is Mark Zandmiller, and then next after that is AJ Kitt. So Mark, there you are, Mark.
Okie dokie. Thanks a lot for still being here with us. It's nice to see you guys, at least on video, so thanks. My name is Mark Zandmiller at 1421 Sherman. We're the neighboring property just to the west along Sherman, and we've lived in this house since 1991. I'm not opposed to the co-housing organization or their hopes to build on the neighboring property. They have to us been friendly throughout, and I know them to be excellent people. That said, I have some real issues with the design presented and hope to see modifications through the approval process. To the proponents, today is much more about the drawings than your values and good intentions. Almost all of my written comments directly relate to the staff report conclusions and conditions, but does not do a very good job of detailing those connections. If keeping the record open for 7 days and allowing me to tie those dots together would be useful, I would be happy to request that. But I guess it's sort of a discussion to see whether you guys would like that kind of connection of the staff report to my comments. There's so many conditions that rely on future submittals and details that made it very difficult to review and comment on our concerns. I question whether 72 conditions is a manageable number to pass from this review to staff and then count on them being addressed through the design process, approval process, implementation process. Sort of going off piste a little bit, the three-story building, number one, is just shockingly out of scale with the neighborhood. And it's hard to get, you know, my head around how big that building right next to us is. Until the January meeting, we weren't aware that such a large building was even being considered. As the city looks to add this type of infill, which I support, avoiding this type of jarring interface between the new and the existing should be our goal. And if we are careful, should go a long way towards general acceptance of infill. As presented, I'm afraid that approving such a big building right next to the existing homes will be used as a general indictment of infill in the whole planning process and work against our efforts to encourage and have acceptance of these housing types. I hope, and this is really for the applicants, is that I hope that, you know, you can still have time to look at some alternatives to address the magnitude of that building. You know, just one really quick thing is, because building two and building three start about 13 feet below building one, if those were the three-story buildings, they would all be about the same height and about the same height as the houses that we have built. Related but not in my written submittal is the planned sidewalk along Eugene. Okay, well, I'm just going to get through about a third of this. That's too bad. Is pretty hurtful on that little strip of neighborhood. And just during this call, I was thinking that what about doing a walking path along the Hazel Alley to and not muck with all those yards along Eugene? So think about that. I guess given that I haven't been able to go over very many of this, I do request the extension to further tie my comments to the planning report. So
Mark, I'm going to take that as a formal request. I see Dustin's popped up. So we're going to take that as a formal request to leave the record open for a minimum of 7 days. We'll talk about details in a couple of minutes. But as a matter of law, I think that we're automatically, but pretty much we have no discretion in whether we accept or don't accept that. So everyone can trust that there will be 7 days of additional testimony available. And we'll talk about that again in a minute. So thank you for that request. And next is AJ Kitt. And then I'll ask if there's anyone in addition who wishes to speak. So AJ, your turn.
Hi, and I'd also like to ask to keep the record open for 7 days as well. AJ Kitt.
Yeah, it's open for everybody, so no problem there.
I know, I'm just being in support.
Okay, appreciate that.
AJ Kitt, 1428 Eugene. I also own 1422 Eugene, which my parents live in. So I have two of the 10 houses on Eugene Street that are going to be impacted by our new neighbors. And I know that the decisions that you guys are going to make is based on the merits of the code and the application. but I just want to put a few things into perspective. Access, as we've talked about, is going to be down Eugene Street. 100% of the vehicle access is going to be burdened upon this small little neighborhood that's been here since the 50s. The development's in R3 use, and the Eugene Street's in an R1 neighborhood. And Arthur, you had mentioned other cases where there's R1 next to R3 in town, but they don't include large-scale multifamily development. They resemble more about the R2 and R1 neighborhoods that surround them. The parking lot, as a matter of perspective, covers 19,000 square feet of ground, okay? The lot that it sits next to with a modest one-story home is 13,000 square feet in size. So you're going to have one third again larger of a chunk of asphalt and a maintenance building sitting next to a lot that a family has lived in for 60 years. That's a massive differential. Also, the scale of building one, 15 dwellings, approximately 158 feet in length. I did some research around town. It's going to be the largest exclusively residential building in the city of Hood River, and not by a small margin, by about a third. The footprint itself is 7,200 square feet. The next largest that I found was up at Indian Creek Apartments, which is 6,200 square foot footprint. But with the three-story scale to this building, the mass is 250,000 cubic feet, where the Indian Creek building is 155,000 cubic feet. So by about 100,000 cubic feet, this is gonna be the largest residential building in the city of Hood River. And it's sitting right in the middle of nothing but detached single family dwellings. Let's see here. Events, the Adams Creek Co-Housing promotes events, they hold events. There's no provision for accommodating parking on their property for these events. They advertise events on their website, they've been holding them. They propose a minimum of a parking space and a half. It's the bare minimum that the code requires. And in comparison, Mountain View Condo Association or Mountain View Condo Community up off of Avalon, they have over two parking spaces per dwelling. Orchard View Manor Condos off of Pacific Avenue, they've got more than three parking spaces per dwelling up there. And in both of those cases, there is no burden on the neighborhood streets for off-street parking that overflows out of the neighborhood. The topography and the creek, I think, make this a very unique site, and it makes it a site that's really worth taking a close look at and making sure that this application is really tight. They can't use half their land, and they're saying that they're dedicating it to protecting the environment, when in reality, and I'm not disputing that they are, but in reality, they don't even have the option to use it. And so they're having to cram a high density of all of their uses, their buildings, their parking, into one spot. And this this community, which so much effuses about its values, is turning its most burdensome attributes off to the neighbors. The parking, the scale of the building, and you know, potentially the noise nuisance, and definitely the traffic, is all being burdened by the neighboring R1 neighborhood. So
if you could wrap up.
Yeah, this is a pivotal land use application for the city of Hood River. Nothing like this has been applied for before. So I really urge you, for the reasons that there are so many conditions, and this is such a unique application that is clearly not fully vetted and fully planned out, I urge you guys to ask them to bring more information back. I'm not against the property being developed, and I'm not against the added density down there for R3. It's just having that massive building and that massive amount of parking right there is very difficult for us.
Thank you very much, AJ. So now we have no one else listed for opponents, but I will open the floor to additional opponents who wish to speak. I see Jason Barker has raised a hand, so I'm going to assume that that's someone who wishes to speak. And anyone else, raise your hand and we'll try to catch you. Jason, do you wish to speak in opposition?
Yeah, I do, and thank you, Commissioner Babbitt. My name is Jason Barker. I live at 709 Cady's Lane, so I'm in the development immediately to the south of the proposed co-housing development. I'm also speaking on behalf of the HOA and the board of the HOA, and my comments are really focused specifically on this passageway that's being proposed as a condition. And on that note, I want to keep the record open and preserve for appeal compliance with 1720.03b4 of the code. We put simply, it's a private right-of-way. It's an asset of our HOA. It's not a city street. It's not a City of Hood River asset. We have a significant portion of our budget, and I add that we've been approved as a low-income community initially back years past, is put specifically to road maintenance. So we certainly cannot, and without the vote of the homeowners, even offer our private roadway as a solution to a public right-of-way issue. I'm a little disappointed that we didn't have any formal outreach from the architect or to the board or the City of Hood River. So that's the specific issue I would preserve on appeal. I would also add that I did speak directly to Mrs. Ramey about this, I guess some time ago, I think it was May 17th of 2019, although it wasn't in her capacity as commissioner. She did approach me about it because she was promoting a greenway through that, our community. And I said, it's really a liability issue for us, because if we have a kid going through the, to the middle school through the co-housing development and then through our private right-of-way, as far as I understand it, I'm not a municipal lawyer, but I am an attorney. It would be our liability if something was to happen to a child going through there. So I don't view that as a solution. And I also think that there are other solutions available for that particular component, as there are sidewalks going up Eugene. There's other ways to get to the pool, the middle school, et cetera. So with that, I'll let you explain to me what the requirements are for, providing a submission.
Great. So, thank you, Jason. Stay there for a minute, because I want to ask staff, did you get adequate information there to understand what objection Jason is making? Dustin, are you there?
Yep. Yes, I understood his concern. Yep.
Okay, and he's presented you with what you need, right?
Just verbally right now.
Yep. Okay, Jason, are you satisfied?
Yeah, absolutely, and I'll put it in writing to the extent is required.
Great, thank you very much. We have, Jonathan, it looks like we have two more people with raised hands, is that correct?
That's correct, Arthur.
Can you call on whoever you think raised their hand first?
Sure, to me, Ms. Kelly Morris.
Great. I'm sorry, Kelly, hold on a second. I'm resetting the timer. And is that the same Kelly Morris who was going to be spoken for by Dan Bell?
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I'm on shift as a nurse right now. I appreciate your patience. I got somebody to let me go for a few minutes so I could talk to you all. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, we certainly appreciate it. Go ahead, then just give us your name and address, and then we'll start the timer.
My name's Kelly Morris. I own the property at 603 Andes Way. I directly border the proposed Adams co-housing project at 1419 Sherman Avenue. I want you to consider the negative impacts of the housing development and the magnitude that it will have on the surrounding long existing neighborhoods, including my own home. I'm very concerned that the current iteration of the project came to us by means of ongoing misrepresentation and poor planning. The way that the project was originally represented to us was several single-story yurt-like structures with one common house, and what we have here now is a far departure from what we originally were presented. Communication was sparse from the time of July to about January 2020, when the mandatory public informational session was proposed, where none of us could attend. I personally was in Baja. I didn't even know it happened. The plans were allowed to go before city planning with like little to no genuine buy-in from the surrounding community, people that it would be directly affecting, and the requests that were made by the planning department for provisional approval were not met by the developer, yet the planning department made the provisional approval anyway on June 3rd. So my concerns are that the green space and the wetlands to be developed that has a value that could be developed more accountably. The large-scale development is wrong for this small, undulating, densely wooded area with wetlands. creek passing through. I don't know how they can say that the environmental impact will be minimal and that no wetlands will be disturbed if an environmental study hasn't even been conducted. Not that it's required, but it would be prudent to do so. The staff report we found out recommends 72 conditions for approval, including significant concerns regarding stormwater drainage, parking allocation, ADA compliance, and pedestrian thoroughfare, which begs the question, if an application has 72 conditions that haven't been met yet, should it really be in a place to be considered? The amount of disturbance and hardship to longtime homeowners, directly adjacent to the property will be drastic, especially myself and my neighbors on Eugene Street. I'll be experiencing the noise and light pollution of 185 trips a day that will be literally parked outside my bedroom window by the plans about 10 feet. The co-housing group has made no concession to account for how they're going to mitigate that for us. Along those lines, I know you've heard that Eugene Street, there are currently 10 resident street will be disturbed by the same 185 trips per day through their property. I should also mention the inevitable decrease in property value that none of us could have anticipated buying our homes 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago.
You can wrap up, please, Kelly.
Of course. I think that the purpose while we're all here is to build a city responsibly, and this is not a responsible use of one of the very last remaining wetland areas in Hood River. This is the largest high density development that we have yet to see in Hood River, and it's going in a relatively small land space. I hope that the Planning Commission respectfully will consider more responsible and accountable development strategies to benefit the community as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kelly, and I hope you have a good shift back at work.
Next,
Jonathan, who's next on the list? Or who's next? Who's raised their hand next?
Yeah, it's Dan Bell.
Okay, Dan, so do you have a procedural problem or a...
You can hear me okay?
We do, yes.
Okay, I wanted to make, to reiterate the other requests to keep the record open. On the grounds that the applicant showed us maps and other materials tonight.
You actually don't even need grounds, Dan, so don't worry about that.
I'm sorry, Chairman, I do have a point. They showed us maps and materials tonight, which we have not seen and are not part of the planning record, and I would request that those be made available to those of us who are trying to follow the project as part of the application.
So can you please be clear so that staff knows exactly what you're requesting?
I'm sorry. As part of their application, they did not submit a retaining wall plan. And so they showed a number of diagrams that showed retaining walls. They showed diagram site plan permits, which included some of the wetlands overlaid with the stormwater system. Those are all diagrams and things that we've not seen as part of the application. I'm sorry if I'm incorrect there, but they looked new.
No, I understand. So, am I correct? You're asking basically for the slide deck that he used in his presentation today?
Yeah.
Did that meet your requirement?
That those become available, and then we have 7 days to review those and comment back.
Okay. So, you're asking for 7 days from when you have those slides available, is what your request is?
Yes. Or other alternative of those plans that they showed tonight.
We'll talk about it as a commission in a minute.
Thank you.
We appreciate that request. Jennifer, you have a question for him?
I was just going to clarify, we will need that presentation for the public record as well.
Yes, so it will be part of the public record anyway, but he wants to make sure that he has access to it. So,
understood.
And I know that you're good at getting that stuff out as soon as you get it in, so we appreciate that. So let me clarify, is there anyone else who wishes to speak this evening in opposition to this? Application. Any other hands raised? Jonathan, did we process all the raised hands?
It looks as though we do not have any more hands, Chair.
Okay, great. So where we are is we've heard the public testimony from the applicant, then we've heard proponents, we had no neutral, and then we heard opponents. And now we've had a request to keep the record open. So Usually what happens in this case, as I said, as a matter of law, we're required to leave the record open for at least 7 days. I'm going to ask for the attention of the commissioners again, because we have to decide exactly what we want to do. And let me just check with staff. There's one thing I'm a little confused about. Just remind me, when we do this, so there's no reason now to hear rebuttal, because there may be additional testimony to rebut. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're not, with the request to keep the record open, we are now going to accept new evidence on any matter, unrestricted, technically, if the commission approves it, for 7 days, or as required, for 7 days. Right. Any participant can submit new information. Then proceeding, we would have 7 days to review. All parties would have 7 days to review that new evidence or the evidence on the record. And then the applicant would be given 7 days to rebut that, in which we would return.
Okay, but what I'm talking about is there's usually a verbal rebuttal that the applicant gets to the verbal testimony. Traditionally, when we keep the record open, it's for additional written information. So remind me how we traditionally deal with the rebuttal session from the, you know, usually we wrap this up with rebuttal from the applicant and then with staff's final comments. So I'm kind of sidetracking those right now, aren't I?
Yeah, it would, if we're going to have more evidence to be provided, it would seem out of sequence for the applicant to rebut an incomplete record.
Okay, but it would be in keeping with our general practice if we kept the record open for additional written proposals. There's a head that's appeared in Bill's in Bill's screen. the wonders of Zoom. So it would be in keeping with the traditions of with the way we traditionally process these, to keep the record open for written submissions, and then at our continued hearing to begin the hearing with rebuttal from the applicant and final statements from staff, and then close the record and go into deliberation. Is that the way that you would see this process going?
That seems like an appropriate sequence.
Okay, so now I need to ask the Planning Commission. In the past, what we've done is we've kept the record open for written comments. And so what it sounds like is a sensible thing for us to do now is to open the record for 7 more days of written comments, and then for review period. So as I understand, we won't be able to meet again until the 26th, I'm sorry, so it's the 21st of September is the next available schedule, because we have a hearing already scheduled for the 8th. Is that correct?
That's correct. You have a request for the 8th already.
So why don't you folks throw out a proposal for the record, and then we'll see if the Planning Commission accepts that. Throw out some dates for how long the written record is open and how long the applicant has to review it. Given that the applicant will get to rebut at the next meeting, there really shouldn't be any issue about the length of time, is there?
Well, seven is customary. And then 7 days to review. So it's not just the applicant that gets to review. We have 7 days of information from all sides. So all participants, applicant, neighbors, everyone has the opportunity then to review that after 7 days. I think Dan Bell mentioned that his desire to see that information. So that would make sense that all parties get to review what's on the record.
Okay. And so let me suggest, I think Dan made a good point that he'd like to have submissions from today in some form he can look at it before we start the 7 day clock. That sounds like a reasonable request. So I'm presuming that the applicant can provide that immediately and staff can turn that around tomorrow. Does that sound reasonable, Jennifer?
Yeah, I was going to suggest that you have the record open until end of business on the 25th of August.
Okay.
And Dustin can take a look at the calendar and see if that, and then the next 7 day mark would be September 1st. And the 7 day mark after that would be September 8th.
Great, and September 8th, we have a Planning Commission meeting. So So, Commission, that is the proposal that staff is making, that we set those three dates for the first one is for completing additional testimony in writing. The second is for reviewing testimony. And the third is for responding to testimony that's been submitted. Oh, Dan has come back. Dan, are we doing this right?
Yes, sounds like it. 777 is a common a revolving door for open record. The thing is that basically opponents get the last word on evidence, but the applicant always gets the last word on legal argument. So at the very end, 7 days final rebuttal for the applicant.
So Dan, the issue here though is that we never went to verbal rebuttal, so the applicant hasn't had a chance to rebut all the things that were said today. Don't we traditionally allow the applicant to speak to rebut?
It's if they have the strength for it, sure. Otherwise, for sure, they always get 7 days after the record closes to everybody else, and I oftentimes ask if they have anything they want to say at the end of the oral testimony. Given that option.
What I'm asking for though is I'm trying to close oral testimony today, but to allow the applicant to rebut orally. Is that allowed?
Right now?
No.
You could do it if you want. I mean, usually this is their chance for oral final rebuttal. State law recognizes written final rebuttal as the big final right that the applicant gets. Yeah.
So what you'd recommend is that we allow them to rebut now anything they wish to rebut if they wish to speak, and otherwise they can rebut anything in writing on that 7-day revolving schedule, so by the 21st day.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. So commissioners, sorry, you think I've done this enough times I would have it figured out, but it's a little complicated. So what staff has recommended is that we leave the written record open for 7 days starting tomorrow. So that would end the written record for new submissions on, so 18th to 25th of August. And then we would allow review time up to September 1st, and then rebuttal deadline for September 8th, and then schedule the next hearing continued to the 21st of September. Did you guys all follow that? So that is the proposal from staff. Would someone care to make a motion to that effect?
Sure. I'll make a motion that we follow the proposed schedule that you just outlined.
Thank you, Bill. Do I have a second on that motion?
I will second.
Erica will second.
Okay.
Oh, we got a second from Erica. It sounds like she got in there a bit ahead of you, Mark. So we have a motion and a second to follow the schedule, which has us keeping written testimony open until August 25th, and then giving everyone 7 days to review it up until September 1st, and then allowing rebuttal up until September 8th, with the hearing reconvening on September 21st. So that's the motion. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, those in favor, or are there any opposed? Any opposed? Okay, seeing none opposed, we have a consensus on that. So we will use that that schedule that was just agreed upon, and staff will put that on the website tomorrow, and the clock isn't starting until tomorrow. And the applicant will provide the slide deck to staff by noon tomorrow, so that staff can get that out to everybody so that the clock starts on time. So everyone good with that? There's nothing else on the agenda.
I see that there's a hand raised in the audience.
Oh, I'm sorry. So Ann Meadows has raised her hand, and I assume there's other two hands raised. So let's clarify any questions that people have. So. Jonathan, if you could bring Ann forward to start with, Ann Meadows.
Yes, thank you. This is just a point of clarification. Will the applicant be allowed an opportunity for oral rebuttal in that future hearing?
Right. So I just screwed that up, didn't I? Because Dan had suggested that we should allow the applicant oral rebuttal now and then written rebuttal by September 8th. So Dan, what do you suggest I do here?
See if the applicant has any remarks they would like to make by way of rebuttal tonight, understanding, you know, we've got this open record thing coming.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, I'm also prepared to answer some of the questions that have been raised tonight, if you so choose.
Okay. So we didn't actually continue the meeting. We agreed on a calendar for continuation. So we haven't gone past the point where we can correct this. So the question for the commission now is whether we're going to continue on the agenda that we stated, which would now have rebuttal from the applicant, verbal rebuttal, and then let staff respond to some of the questions that have been raised, recognizing that there will be final rebuttal in writing by September 8th. Is everyone okay with that? Hopefully we can do that relatively quickly.
Are you saying you want the rebuttal now? And the,
I'm sorry, who's speaking?
Oh, it's Mark.
Mark, yes. So that would be verbal rebuttal now. If the applicant wishes, give the applicant a chance to speak now to rebut some of the points that were made so far, but recognize that they that their formal rebuttal will not end until September 8th when they have a chance to rebut all the additional things that are submitted. Okay.
Okay.
So it sounds like we're going with that. But before we do that, there are several additional hands that have been raised. So let me process all of that. Jonathan, can you call upon the next person? I assume this has been sufficiently confusing that people don't know where we're going. So I see Seth has raised his hand. Seth, do you have a procedural question or are you preparing to rebut now?
Both, actually. First, the procedural clarification. If it is possible, the applicant would request the opportunity to make a verbal rebuttal at the hearing on September 21st.
So that will have to be a decision of the Planning Commission. So let me come back to that in a minute. Before you speak, so let's figure out if we're going to allow that or if this is your only chance. Just to be clear, you're asking to do that instead of speaking today?
Correct.
Okay. Someone else wishes to speak, so let's see what the additional question is before I ask the Planning Commission. Dan Bell, go ahead. Dan, we're not hearing you.
Hello, yeah. Hey, can you hear me now?
Okay, we hear you now. Yeah, thank you.
Again, Dan Bell, 1509 Eugene Street. If there is going to be rebuttal, I would recommend that that comes from either the applicant or the applicant's engineer, not project proponents who have previously spoken. So if we're going to hear rebuttal, let's hear it from the applicant, not the proponents. That's all I wanted to say.
So to be clear, you know, what we do is we allow, there's an applicant and we allow rebuttal from the applicant. Who the applicant chooses to speak is their choice.
Thank you, Chairman. I didn't hear a designation of the last speaker as the person providing the rebuttal.
He spoke as the applicant earlier.
Sorry, I'm talking about the female who spoke earlier, Anne.
I'm not sure I can respond to that. I don't think I need to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. We understand your question. I think there's one other hand raised. Is that correct, Jonathan?
No, it was just the first hand raised.
Okay. So I will ask the Planning Commission. The applicant has requested the right to make a verbal rebuttal as opposed to the written rebuttal that Dan has suggested. My inclination is always to close the verbal record at the first meeting. Just to reduce it to the to written back and forth as opposed to verbal back and forth. It seems to me like as soon as we open the verbal, as soon as we give the applicant the right to make more verbal comments, people will ask why the opponents are not allowed to make more verbal comments. So I generally see it done the way that Dan has suggested it, but it's up to the commission to make the decision. So what do people prefer? Commissioners? Anyone wish to speak? If no one speaks, the way we left it was that we're accepting only written information after tonight. So we still do have the ability to allow the applicant to finish their rebuttal, to do the verbal portion of the rebuttal tonight, recognizing that they'll be able to submit rebuttal in writing up until September 8th, I believe was the date. So
it seems to me that there were a number of, I guess it seems to me that there was a number of issues that were raised, and I wonder how many more issues will be raised in this next 7-day period that we will want to hear back from the applicant. So I wonder if just putting that all in and having one rebuttal verbally in the next meeting would be a cleaner way to do it. I understand what you're saying about in terms of, so what happens after that then? So if they make a return, a rebuttal in the next meeting, are you saying we go back to public testimony?
What I'm saying is that I'm uncomfortable with allowing the applicant to speak again, but not allowing anyone else to speak again.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's, you know, this is the meeting at which people get to speak. You know, people get to submit as much written material as they want before now, then people get to speak in front of us, and then we close the written record, I'm sorry, close the verbal record and let people continue to submit stuff in writing. We do the 7, 7, and 7, and then we, then the record is closed and we deliberate. And I'm a little queasy about doing verbal rebuttal. It's hard for us to review it in time to be prepared to then deliberate on it, for one thing, because we're getting additional information at that meeting. Whereas the schedule that we agreed upon a couple of minutes ago, everything will be well settled by the time we get to our meeting on the 21st. So that's kind of my opinion, yeah. But go ahead, Bill.
I guess the only question I would ask would be for the applicant, is during the submittal period, do they expect to be submitting additional information that we have not seen tonight on some of the topics raised?
I suppose we can ask them, but I'm not sure how they would know. Oh, you're talking about during the first 7 days?
Yeah.
Okay, Dan, can we ask the applicant that?
You could, but state law allows, and your order would allow, new evidence to be submitted as long as the record is open up until the time for final rebuttal. Final rebuttal is argument only, no new evidence. So until then, new evidence could come in. And quite frankly, the question that Dan Bell had about allowing the applicant's engineer to speak, I wouldn't recommend it at final rebuttal because basically engineers generally provide new evidence, but new evidence is not allowed in final rebuttal. Yeah.
Yeah. Understand. So, Bill, given that, do you want to ask that question?
I'm not sure I do with Dan's clarification. I think he understands.
Okay. Then we'll take that as a no. Anyone else want to say anything on this? So what are we going to do? Does someone want to make a motion to do something different than what we agreed upon before was there would be no further opportunity for oral testimony after tonight. Do we want to modify that to allow for an oral rebuttal or not? So do you want to make a motion to that effect, Mark, or not?
Well, what does everybody else think?
Well, you have to make a motion.
Original motion.
If you get a second.
I'll make a motion that we take the verbal rebuttal tonight.
Okay, so that's a little different than what Mark suggested. Do we have a second for that?
I would prefer the original motion.
There wasn't a motion. I'm sorry, which original motion?
Sorry, the
the 777, the first.
I think that's what Bill is suggesting. Bill is following on with that, saying we finish up the verbal tonight, where Mark was suggesting that we allow the verbal to be finished on the 21st.
Now I'm totally confused. I'm sorry.
We have two options. So we already agreed on the 777, but we have the remaining issue that the applicant has not had a chance to speak in rebuttal. And that's something that we had on our agenda for this evening. The applicant has said that if we are willing to let them speak verbally on the 21st, then they would waive that portion which we had scheduled for this evening. I have suggested that we don't do that, that we let them speak this evening and let them submit in writing for the 21st.
This is Erica.
Mark has suggested, has asked alternately, what do we, you know, he started to make a motion, but kind of pulled back and said, what do you guys think? So that's what the question is. What do you guys think?
It's late. Can we do what will allow us to postpone to the next meeting since it's 9:30 almost?
So you're agreeing with what Mark had proposed, that we give them the ability to speak at the next meeting?
Yes.
Okay, so would you like to make a motion to that effect?
Well, I'd go ahead and do that. So this is
okay,
Mark.
So Mark makes the motion.
So
we have a second.
So I make a motion that we allow the verbal rebuttal to occur at the next Planning Commission meeting. September.
Okay, do I have a second on that?
I second that.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Megan.
Okay, so Mark makes a motion and Megan seconds that we allow the applicant to make a verbal rebuttal at the meeting on September 21st. Any discussion? Bill?
I guess I'll ask the question of what the difference is versus just continuing the entire hearing.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, we've got this additional... And it goes back to the whole, I guess, written record and the structure. And this is a question for Dan. The structure that we've outlined. I mean, it seems like in any rebuttal that comes from the applicant, we're going to have new information if it's verbally. I would think
rebuttal is supposed to be argument only, as Dan said. So there's no new evidence in a rebuttal.
Okay.
And that's how that allows the record to be closed. Otherwise, records never get closed.
Yep. Agreed.
You know, the whole revolving door can go on forever.
Yes.
So this is why I'm being careful with this, because I want to close it.
Right.
If we're not really careful on this, we can wind up with things open. And that's why I prefer not to have anything orally after today, because doing so creates the opportunity for the door to stay open more than we wanted it to. And we can say everything we want about, no, don't worry. We're going to hear nothing but rebuttal on the 21st, but it may wind up being something that requires us to reopen the record because of a legal reaction, a legal response from any other party who says that new information was submitted and they need a chance to comment on that. And then they get another 7 days, and then the 7 days of review and 7 days of rebuttal. So I'm really, my instinct is to vote against the proposal that Mark has moved, because of the desire to not keep this record, to not let this record go on endlessly. So any other discussion of the motion that Mark made? Okay, so we have a motion on the floor to allow the applicant to write a verbal rebuttal at the meeting on the 21st. Those in favor? I need to see some indication. So Mark and Tina and Megan are in favor. Okay, those opposed? Sue and Bill are
Erica
opposed.
Erica is in favor. Sorry, Erica is in favor.
Geez, Erica, how do we get a tie with seven of us? Okay, so Erica is in favor. So I am opposed. So it's a 4-3 vote. So we're allowing the applicant to make a rebuttal at the meeting on the 21st of September, so we won't be hearing that tonight. I guess let me just remind the applicant that, as Dan said, rebuttal is to be argument only, not evidence. You know all about the revolving door. It's in your interest not to reopen that door, so please don't do so. And with that, it sounds like we have no reason now to hear from the applicant and staff. It sounds like if we haven't heard from the applicant, we have no reason to hear from you. Is that correct, Jennifer?
That's up to you.
Is there any reason not to, we're going to want to hear a final statement from staff on the 21st anyway. Any reason to hear from them today? I'm not seeing anyone jumping up and down. So let me clear this. Are we okay now with recessing until the 21st with this schedule that we just put in place?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So with that, it looks like we have agreement on that. We are in recess. I appreciate everyone's patience today. This is hard stuff. Thank you everyone for all your patience in your late evening. Have a good evening, and we will see you again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Arthur. Thanks.
Bye-bye. And my battery just indicated